Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to Tuesday. Welcome to the 23rd of September. I don't know how to begin this except to begin this. All day long, I've been watching and paying attention to more bailout stuff. And look, I hope the Democrats will be Democrats and do what Democrats darn well ought to do. I hope that they will stop as much of this rape, this ripoff, this scourging of the backs of the American working people that this bailout represents as they possibly can. I hope it. I pray it. I wish it. All those magic words I apply to the bailout. But the fact of the matter is, here at 2.5 minutes past the hour, that while we watch the bailout, and while we watch everything that unfolds around it, I know of at least one person in this nation. I know of at least one person in this nation who doesn't give a rat's ass, pardon me, about the bailout. There is in this nation at least one person for whom the bailout is utter and absolute meaningless trivia. That person's name is Troy Davis. Here, if everything goes as planned, here in about 56, can you imagine looking at your life this way? Here in about 56 minutes and change, Troy Davis will be dead. He will be dead by at the hands of the people of Georgia. He will be dead by reason of horizontal crucifixion, for that is what lethal injection is. He will be dead. No, he will not. He will not. A stay of execution has been granted to Troy Davis. I didn't think it was possible. Wow. Just broke. Just a couple of minutes ago. He would have been killed tonight in the name of the people of Georgia at 7 p.m. Eastern Time for the murder he did not commit of a Savannah, Georgia police officer. The stay literally came in the 11th hour, 23rd hour, if you will. This is a dirty, dirty case. And the Supreme Court of the United States actually stayed the execution. Bear in mind that 7 of the 9 witnesses who initially testified that Davis was the killer have long since recanted their testimony. Police officer off duty working as a security guard outside of Burger King in 1989 was gunned down. The Georgia Parole Board said, kill him. Don't care if he's innocent.
Kill him anyway.
Savannah, Georgia wanted him dead. White folks all over America wanted him dead. But the stay of execution has been granted. It is far from a release, but it is a stay of execution granted by the Supreme Court of the United States. And you know what? It gives me just a little bit of hope to see that we can actually do the right thing. And to experience it, to sit it, because I haven't been able to put the proper focus on the bailout all day long, because I kept thinking, you know, what the hell does the bailout mean to a man who is about to be horizontally crucified in the name of punishment and vengeance? Oh, and don't forget Christianity, because, you know, in Georgia, we're a Christian nation, you know. And render unto Caesar the renderings of Troy Davis. Hallelujah. Praise Jesus. So bear in mind, of course, the victim's mother, Annalisa McPhail of Columbus, Georgia, said last week that she's disgusted by the calls not to murder Troy Davis for a crime that he didn't commit. Then she also said, there is no possibility he's innocent, not according to what's been said in court. Troy Davis was judged by his peers. All the courts have found him guilty. It was proven he's guilty. Please let us have some peace. Let Mark rest in peace. Let justice be done. Well, actually, justice has been done. The Georgia Supreme Court said, nope, we're going to kill him. Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole said, nope, don't kill him. And the Supreme Court of the United States actually called an emergency session to hear the petition today. What the outcome will be, I don't know. You don't know. But it is a hopeful sign that we have decided not to slaughter a potentially innocent man. After all, at least the way I view things, capital punishment is not worth it for all the guilty in the world if one innocent is murdered in the name of the people. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hey, what's up?
I haven't called in for quite a while.
It has been. How are you?
I'm just fine. I'm sitting here in the Scappoose, Oregon, Obama campaign office.
Oh, very good.
Taking a break from phone banking.
And how is that going?
Well, not bad. Not bad at all. The reason I called is, of course, the legalized, I can't decide what it, what, I like Randy Rhoads' term for it, buying your own rape kit.
Well, that, you know, and that's the thing that I kept coming back to last night, Susan, is that Sarah Palin's town forcing raped women to buy their own rape kits at $1,000 a pop. No, I shouldn't say pop. At $1,000 a kit. It really is emblematic for what they hope to do to America, isn't it?
Sure. And, you know, it just kills me that Paulson is screaming, you know, give me the money, give it to me now, it has to be done now, hurry, 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 fear, fear, fear. Everything's going to collapse. You know what I say to that? Let it crash.
Well, that's...
Let it go.
I recognize that may be irresponsible, but it's also something that's inside of my tiny noggin, too. I don't think it's possible to just resist that.
Well, I'm going on history. In 1929, they tried all of this. They tried the bailouts, they tried the whole nine yards, and it didn't do a bit of good. It just prolonged the agony and made the recovery that much harder. Fine. Let it crash. And then we can get around up to the business of putting things back together again.
Well, see, that's the thing with what Bush said today. I'm just so sick of this little moron. Today, Susan, he said, this is no time for partisanship. We need to move urgently needed legislation as quickly as possible without adding controversial provisions that could delay action. Yeah, doesn't that just make you, just throw a rock, kick a piece of furniture, whatever. You know, they're the ones that added the controversial provisions that have delayed action. I mean, the Section 8 business where there's no oversight and he just Paulson just gets to go on a spending spree.
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
That's flat unconstitutional.
You would think so. I mean, I don't know. Does Congress, I guess this is a question for Mark Levine, and maybe we'll find out tomorrow. Would Congress have the authority to delegate away its powers of the purse?
I don't know, but I know Congress does not have the authority to delegate away the powers of the judicial branch.
Because the judicial branch isn't party to the process.
Yeah, and according to this, even the judicial branch would be prohibited. And they're and that would mean the Supreme Court. Sorry, folks, that's unconstitutional on its face.
You would think so, yes. I mean, you can't, I suppose you could amend the Constitution to do that, but you can't, all legislation is junior, so to speak, to the Constitution itself, so you can't, I would think not, by legislation, you can't take away constitutionally granted powers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is, can the Congress simply abdicate constitutionally granted powers? I don't think they can do that either, although they did it with the Iraq War and occupation. But that's not
another thing that just makes me crazy, this whole thing. Hurry up, do it now, fear, fear, terror, terror. Okay, we did this. It's called the Patriot Act. It's called the Iraq War Authorization. It's called all of it. Everything just wanted done. It's been fear, fear, terror, terror. Do it now, quick, quick, go quick.
Well, and Dear Leader was out there. He said, we must act now to protect our nation's economic health from serious risk. What plant? What colors the sky on his world? The nation's economy is already suffering serious risk.
Yeah, I saw a deal where
suffering harm. Yeah.
Yeah, where they said we need to do this now, or we're going to go into a recession. Honey, we've been in a recession.
Seems that way to me, but you couldn't tell it by the silk suit crowd.
Oh, God, let it crash. Let it go.
And you know the darndest thing, Susan? And you know how hard I am on pig lickings. I wouldn't trust one with a dead skunk, okay? But I was watching the hearings, and of all people...
You found yourself agreeing with a Republican. I did, too.
Richard Shelby. And, yeah. And I mean, I wouldn't trust him with a live skunk, a dead skunk, or a handful of skunk... Okay?
I know.
But he said, but at least I have to give the man a little bit of respect for sticking true to his principles, because he sat there and he looked Paulson and Bernanke square in the eye and he said, I'm suspicious of this plan because we have said all along that the market, the free market will always correct itself. And he said, it's correcting us, and the correction is painful, but we ought to let the free market work. And at least he's not a hypocrite. Now, on the other hand, I was over at WD40.com, Susan, and I'm sure, I know you've been there.
Yeah.
And I never do, I guess, a good enough job of explaining that website address. It is D-U-B-Y-A-D, then the numeral 4, and then the numeral 0.com, WD40.com. And what they had a quote today from South Carolina Senator Jim Demented. And this guy is really, you know, nuts, okay? Yep. Listen to this quote, Susan, and you know, I hope your fellow phone bankers don't start looking at you funny when you howl. These are the words of Jim Demented. And he's from South Carolina. After reviewing the administration's proposed bailout plan, I believe it is completely unacceptable. This plan does nothing to address the misguided government policies that created this mess and could make matters much worse by socializing an entire sector of the U.S. economy. This plan fails to oversee or regulate the government failures that led to this crisis. No, really, he said that. I'm not kidding.
I know he said it, and I'm sitting here with my mouth open because he said the Godfather's truth.
Well, no, but he said that government policies created this mess. It was the absence of government policy.
Yeah.
And government failures led to the crisis, but those government failures were sins of omission and not commission. This is the price we pay for the Enronization of Wall Street.
Yep.
But yet, no, it's the government's fault. Ain't nothing wrong with the Wall Streeters. They're just wonderful people. You know, they'd be out there just ripping us off left and right. That's their job on Wall Street. It's the government. The government created this problem.
Yeah. But, yeah, it just, as far as I'm concerned, let these yahoos, they swam in a lake of funny money for years. It was all funny money.
Well, yes, it is. It's monopoly money.
Yeah, and they thought they were just the world's greatest, the greatest thing to hit the planet. And now it's tubes, and they're going with it. Well, guys, them's the risk. You play those kind of games, you're going to run the risk. What are those commercials, you know, for these places that sell stocks to people? And they always say, as with any financial transaction, there is some risk.
Yes.
Okay, guys, you assumed the risk. You lost.
But you misunderstand. It's the risk for the schmucks. The house, see, they're still operating on Vegas rules. The house always wins. And they, you know, at this point in time, they figure they've got a right to, you know, they lose people's money, but we got to pay them for the money they lost.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, and I realize this is only my opinion, and I'm just a single Democrat, but as far as I'm concerned, we're the house, and they lost, and we own the house. I'm sorry, guys, you're SOL. Let it crash.
How do you... Let it do what it does.
Yeah, crash it. And then we can put it back, and we can put the safeguards back in that Graham and his cronies took out. And we can put them back in, and then we can start things back up again.
Yeah. And you know what's really annoying? On the face of it, I hate being in an agreement with either Richard Shelby or Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
I know, it's really irritating.
Because Ahmadinejad, and you know, he doesn't really run Iran. He's not the guy.
No.
But he said that George Bush is, George Bush and U.S. military interventions around the world are partly to blame for the collapse of global financial markets. Said it to the UN General Assembly.
He's right.
Yeah, he kind of is, isn't he?
Yep. And I'm not saying that because I think the dear boy is wonderful or anything like that. I think he's a creep, but he's right. Even stopped clock is right twice a day.
Yeah, exactly. And in this case, do all those supposed free marketeers out there, Susan, do they actually think that you can run a multi-billion, nearly trillion-dollar war and occupation? Do they think you can run that on hot checks and not have to pay for it sooner or later?
Well, they think that the government's going to come in and then they're going to loot the government again. They think they're going to have another shot at all that, all those no-bid contracts and all that stuff. Well, not if I have anything to say about it.
So what's the talk there among your fellow the Obama workers? I mean, what are they thinking?
We ain't buying it for a minute.
Well, good. Now, and I'm still asking the same question because all I've got is anecdotal stuff from two generations back. But I'm still asking the same questions I was asking last night, and I never really got as much of an answer as I'd hoped for.
I can give you an answer.
What does America look like if we let it crash?
Well, I can give you an answer. Hubby lived through the Depression.
Yes, he did.
And what it looks like is you go back to basics. You go back to making sure you have enough to eat. And, you know, there's none of this high-flying consume. What we will need to do is rebuild this country from the ground up because we will need a manufacturing base.
And that's the one thing they had in the Great Depression that we do not have.
Yeah, and we shouldn't have any problem with something like the equivalent of the CCC, where Roosevelt had such a hard time with it. We won't have any problem with it at all because he worked before.
Yep. So,
put those people to work.
Well, it's
a lot
it's,
of people are going to find doing manual labor for very little money.
Well, this is all living proof of politics makes strange bedfellows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's crazy old Ron Paul out there saying don't bail out Wall Street. There's Richard Shelby. You know, David Sirota's out there. Move On's organizing, you know, group after group after group. Stop the bailout. Stop the bailout. Stop the bailout.
Well, you know that economist from SMU that he's on Hartman Lott?
Oh, yeah. Can't, no name. Got right there, tip of the tongue.
Yeah. According to him, even with the bailout, before the whole thing crashes anyway.
Well, that's I think bailout or no bailout. That's what I was
it's
trying to point out.
Crash, yeah, it's gonna crash.
And right now, this is good money after bad.
Yeah,
actually, it may be bad money after bad. I don't know that there's any at this point. I don't know that there's any reality to this kind of money.
Yeah, why do you think I was telling you earlier this year? Plant gardens, canned food, so on and so forth. That's why. It's coming. I could see the way the stock market acted because it acted just the same way it did. It was acting just the same way it did in 1929, those wings.
Oh, yeah.
And then, boom, and it's going to crash. Yes, it will. And I just hope that once it does, I hope we have the sense to put Barack Obama in office and then he can be 21st century FDR.
Well, that's what it's going to take. And frankly, you know, I started referring to McCain as John McHoover.
Hey, you know what I'm
saying?
Well,
this would effectively be the 1932 re-election of Herbert Hoover if John McCain reaches the White House.
You know what I'm wearing? I'm wearing a button that was made specifically for me. It says, America doesn't need McHoover. 2008, and it has a picture of John, and in the background, it kind of grayed out, kind of a ghostly image, is a picture of Herbert Hoover.
It's perfect. It's perfect. Mercy
because
sakes.
That's exactly what he is. He's McHoover.
You know, but I got to thinking about it. He may, no, see, that's the thing. Hoover was at least reasonably intelligent. He may actually be dumber than Bush, dumber than Harding, and, yeah, dumber than Hoover. And you're gonna put an idiot in charge of, and the only, you know, it's always the Republicans who say, well, you know, them tax and spend Democrats, they think if you just throw money at it, the problem goes away. Well, who's throwing the money? I mean, isn't that the attitude that they're taking on? That they just want to throw, money at Wall Street and hope that Wall Street can get well? But then again, it's also very Rovian, isn't it, Susan? That whatever they criticize Democrats for is generally what they themselves are pathologically guilty of.
Exactly. And that's, you know.
So are you, let me just ask you real quick. I got to take a couple more calls, but let me just ask you, are you being met with good responses in your phone banking? I mean, is Oregon solidly in Obama's corner?
Oh yeah, Oregon is definitely blue. Washington is trending blue. I picked off data off HuffPo. Earlier, Obama had pulled ahead in one poll in Florida by two. In Florida! Because, let's face it, all those retirees who live on stocks, they're hurting. This economy thing, well, it's not good for us, obviously. It's showing up exactly what the Republicans are, and that trends, that makes things trend Democrat. If I go by the CNN, you know, each news organization puts out a electoral map.
Right, right.
According to CNN's electoral map, if Obama wins Michigan and Minnesota, he's got it. He's over the top.
God, I.
Knock on wood. Knock on wood.
Yeah, that's why I'm pecking myself in the head right now. Can you hear it? Knock on wood. Susan, wonderful to hear from you, and great that you're spending your time this way. I'm so proud of you, and I know everybody else is too.
Well, if anybody is in Western, in the Portland area, or in Southwestern Oregon, and wants to come by and join us at our little celebration. It's from 11 to 2, and it's just off Highway 30 in Scappoose. You won't have any problems finding it.
Wonderful. Well, I hope some folks drop by.
It'll be on the 27th.
Great. Susan, take care and say hi to Donald for us, will you?
I will, and give my love to Agnes.
Sure will. Bye now.
Bye.
Well, that's what you call putting your money where your mouth is. Sure enough. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, hey, Sandra.
Sandra, what's up?
Oh, man, listen. You know, these economic royalists, boy, they really have shown their true colors, haven't they?
Yeah, talk of, you know, cut and run. You know, can't we haul that one out and work it over a little bit? I mean, this is shock and awe, but the fact of the matter is Wall Street wants to look at its losses and cut and run.
No, and it's just a joke because this fool thinks that we're going to revisit their power grab again in the name of some emergency. I mean, listen, at least there's some voices being raised because when I read that pursuant to this, that, or another, I do what I want, no oversight, I was like, here we go again. You know what I mean? That whole quote with decisions by the secretary, you know, no review, no nothing, right? He just wants this money. He wants to pay off his buddies, and we just shut the fuck up and sit down.
Yeah.
And it's just like, are you kidding me? Listen, I just want to share this little thing quickly with you because I was rolling. I'm horrible, but I was laughing. So, did you hear what happened in India?
No.
Okay. Well, corporate India is in shock after a mob of fat workers bludgeoned to death the chief executive who dismissed them from a factory. Hello? In the suburb of Delhi.
Sounds like free market.
No, this mob of 100 said, oh, what? And beat this man to death. Okay? They are in shock. Some other executives said they were lucky to escape with their lives. 60 people were arrested, and more than 20 were in hospital. But the gist of it is that, yeah, you know what I'm saying? It's like that's what happens when you have the huge discrepancy and just blatant. It's real blatant in India, you know what I mean? They don't mess around with their...
Well, they've still got a real life. They've got a caste system that they acknowledge.
No, I know, but I mean, even with this so-called... miracle economics is very sort of directed towards the few, and everybody else is in abject poverty. I just thought it was interesting. The timing is hella funny. This article is in the Times of London. CEO murdered by mob. Hello.
But
you know what? Something's wrong with me for being so pleased about it. But, you know, I am. I was like, I thought, well, that's one way of solving it.
Well, you know, I don't know that it solves, Sandra, but it certainly goes a long way toward keeping them honest.
Well, I'm just saying, okay, yeah, I agree with you, and it is sort of, you know, I don't, violence begets violence and all that sort of, you know, stuff, but I'm just saying, just on the face of it, it's sort of about damn time on some levels. You know what I'm saying? Use some sort of decorum and trying to hide my glee. But I can't help but be somewhat, you know, bemused by it, because how long does this go on for, where people are just being asked to work as slaves while someone just around the corner is getting enriched by it, you know?
Well, I know exactly what you're talking about, and that's why I keep asking this question, Sandra. What there's a huge cost. It's, you know, what's been calculated, $2,000 a person, to bail out the silk suit crowd on Wall Street.
Right.
What is the cost of not doing it?
Oh no, the cost of not doing it is these MFers will not get, you know, as much money as they got last year. That's all. I'm sorry. I understand this whole sort of, oh, the market is freezing up, but listen. You can't do what they're doing because the economy is going to contract, because the mortgages that the government is covering, it's not going to be paid because people aren't getting wages. You see what I'm saying? I mean, macroly speaking, it doesn't make any sense.
So, right, and then that's where my mind keeps going, Sandra, is that is this a financial crisis or is this a fraud crisis?
You said fraud?
Yeah.
Well, no.
What I'm getting at is, All these appreciated stocks that are now depreciating,
yeah.
Aren't we sort of pulling the curtain back or tearing the rubber mask off? Aren't we finding out that it was funny money and phony baloney all along?
Well, yeah, that's the thing, and it's just smoke and mirrors, and these financial instruments which have been created in the last decade are incomprehensible. But what the problem is that what we're going to buy with all this money is toxic debt that they think they can renegotiate. But if you don't have wages rising or people earning money, they're not going to pay it. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
What they need to do is raise the minimum wage to $14 an hour. But that would never happen. They need to change the whole nature of capital and redirect it to work, where it's something that's tangible, not this shuffling of money. Please, I don't mean to go into some, you know, economic whatever. I'm just saying.
No. And I don't think you are.
It's not rocket science, you know, and I'm not an economist, but you know, I follow it, and I know about labor, and labor is tangible, and this shit that we're looking at isn't.
That's why I keep calling it funny money and talking about it in terms of Vegas.
No, but what's not funny, though, is them doing this wholesale transfer, government-mandated transfer of money from the citizens to private interests. That equals socialism. That's what that is.
It's upward. It's just, and there's not that much difference from the beginning of the Bush administration. The Bush administration is going to end the way it began, with wealth distribution upward, from the poor to the rich.
No, and this is even just as blatant as you want to be. But the thing is that, like you were talking about these different quarters kind of raising their voices, A, because it goes against their dogma and ideology. If you're some free marketeer, how the hell can you come up with justification for this? You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. And
I mean, I'm not a free marketeer. I think it's a bunch of bullshit myself.
Well, I think the free market as defined by people like Adam Smith is radically different from what they're talking about here, because the free market under Adam Smith is a free market that's based in real products.
Well, yeah, there is some sort of something, if I get back to that tangibility factor with, you know, although I'm just so appalled by the fact that they've even gotten this far with this bailout. This is a joke.
Well, see, I remember, Sandra, many years back, I had a buddy who was trying to learn the ropes of the life insurance fraud, the racket. And they taught him to talk about, well, you know, this is a whole life product. My rear end, that is not a product. That you can't pull it over you and warm you up on a cold night. Won't keep you cool in the hot weather. It won't keep the sun off your head. It won't fill your belly. It won't clean your skin. It ain't a product. And that's, you know, that's part and parcel of what we're of why we're in this mess, is that we have completely lost track of what it means to what reality is. Those electrons that Lehman Brothers shuffled, or that AIG insured, they were insuring risks and not realities. You know, when Lloyd's of London got started, it was literally a coffee house in London where guys would sit down and bet, literally bet, on whether or not a ship of His Majesty's merchant fleet would make it back to port with the goods.
Mm.
And the payoff was when the thing made it back to port.
Yeah, but back then, that kind of stuff wasn't 25% of the national economy either. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
What it is here, which after it gets up to 30, you got, you know, empire collapse time. I mean, that's what happened to Rome. These are the sort of things that was going on in Rome when that shit went away.
Well, it's so funny you should mention that. You know, my buddy, our buddy, the Internet's sharpest satirist, Eugene Finnerman.
Mm.
He took exactly that tack today, Sandra.
Oh, well, I guess I'm in good company.
You are in very, very good company. he titled today's post, Eugene did, The Bear Market of AD 455.
Shut the hell up. Yeah, man. No, I remember.
And what he produced today was the transcript of Genseric's testimony to the Roman Senate. You're going to love this, Sandra. Senators of Rome. There is no point in telling you that your glorious city has been sacked. Being king of the Vandals, I can speak with an objective perspective. Rome has nothing left to steal. But this is not the time to look for culprits. We must look to the future and restore a Rome that once again is worth looting. So I'm asking you for at least 700 billion denarii to rebuild and revitalize Rome. Believe me, I know exactly what the Vandals have done. Because this is an emergency, I will require your complete cooperation, no questions, no supervision, no appeals to the Pope. In fact, I will require his powers as well. Some of you, on the left side of the Curia, might question a Vandal's reliability. And that is exactly the type of question that can be divisive and unproductive. So as I said, no questions. Some of you might think that the Vandals could lend Rome the money. Well, yes, we have had a good year. That's just a coincidence. But the upkeep of a barbarian horde can be expensive. And unless we sack Constantinople, next year's profits will definitely be down. So despite our sentimental attachment to this city, we Vandals will not be investing in Rome. No, you Romans have to make this effort and scrounge up your last denarii. I'm just here to spend it for you.
Yeah. No,
isn't he something?
No, that's hilarious, because the comparisons are just chilling at this point. And, you know, I just can't deal with the hubris of this fool, the ex, CEO or whatever, chairman of Sachs, Goldman Sachs?
Yeah.
Why in the world should we...
How in the world does he not have a conflict of interest here?
Oh, yes, he is conflict.
I mean, this is a bigger conflict of interest than Cheney acting in behalf of Halliburton.
No, but didn't they want then he wants complete authority, like he's, you know,
the Pope.
And it's just outrageous. And if they do get this in place, what, the same companies that sold bad, horrible mortgages to all the peons out here are going to now control what they're selling to the government? I mean, it's just some sort of, it's like a bad dream, this. You know, it's a horror show.
It is, and the question is, how much of the, you know, no one will be admitted after the first 5 minutes. The question, the zombies are up out of the grave and they're walking around, and the George Bush babbling away, oh, we got to act now, we got to act now.
No, that's their whole mode. It's always, everything's a freaking emergency. We can't have any discussions. We got to do it now. I mean,
yeah. Well, this bailout is it's a Patriot Act for the financial markets,
no,
isn't it?
Or it's like we got to go to Iraq because of the mushroom cloud. It's the same sort of. You know, we're going to freak you out so much that you just roll over and do what we say, and then they move on with the complete dismantlement of whatever is left of this country. I mean,
see, out of this, Sandra, I see some value in the remarks that Barack Obama made at the convention when he talked about honoring the hard work of past generations. This might. Not being the salvation of Wall Street might actually be the salvation of this nation.
Well, I mean, it could go. There are different ways that it can go. Like I said, I mean, you know, it wasn't this morning, but since I got back home, you know, I've been sort of seeing that there is some bubbling outrage and some different voices being raised. Even some of these right-wing economists are like, oh, hold on. When Krugman and Crystal agree, you know something's up, man. They both wrote articles, you know, questioning this bailout, and I just thought that was kind of interesting. I hate Crystal, but...
No, Lord. Yeah, and...
when these freaks hang out about it,
listen, I don't know if you've seen this yet, Sandra. Listen to what Kucinich is proposing, because, you know, you really always can go to Dennis Kucinich for some sanity.
I even gave some money to his campaign, yeah.
He's got 10 points. He says, require all candidates seeking federal office to return contributions from management and board members of companies receiving Treasury assistance. 9, ban political contributions from management and board members of companies receiving Treasury assistance. 8, insist that all members of Congress fully disclose beyond the annual financial disclosure any investments in companies receiving Treasury assistance. 7, include a deadline for termination of bailout legislation. 6, ensure that American families remain in their homes by permitting mortgages to be reworked by bankruptcy judges where appropriate. Otherwise, permit mortgage servicers to use new discretion to modify the terms of a loan. 5, create an auction mechanism to determine fair market value of the mortgage-backed securities to be purchased. 4, equity for taxpayers through the conversion of bad mortgage-backed securities into revenue-generating assets and placing them in a newly created United States Mutual Trust Fund. 3, accountability from the management of companies receiving Treasury assistance, including limits on compensation and any severance packages. 2, strong new regulation and oversight to financial and real estate markets, including the creation of new regulatory entities or the expansion of authority of current regulatory bodies. And 1, repeal of those provisions of the Financial Modernization Act that contributed to the current situation. Hallelujah. Thank the flying spaghetti monster that there's still Dennis Kucinich is out there.
Yeah, well, I know he gets a lot of his economic advice from that Michael Hudson, who's, you know, has an interesting, you know, he breaks it down pretty clearly. If you ever come across his name, you should check out his article.
I absolutely will.
Yeah, he was an economic advisor to Kucinich, at least during his presidential run. But, I'm hoping that, you know, because they just cannot. That's a lot of money, man.
And the thing is, we're not just talking about bum mortgages. You know, part and parcel of this whole process was that the Bush administration said, well, you know, we're going to bail out the questionable investments, too.
Yeah, and
that's part, you know, and that's part of that. That's part of that Paulson, discretion?
And
foreign
firms, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just sort of like, it's just sort of mind-numbing. And what's even more scary is that these bastards thought that this would just slide on through. I don't know what's more disturbing. You see what I mean?
Yes, I do.
That the mindset is such that these people thought that, oh, we're just going to, you know, shift $1 trillion just like that because we say something's wrong. I think we've been bamboozled enough with these people to finally say, wait a minute. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I do indeed.
So. I mean, you should have seen the way the stock market went up just upon word of this. That in itself told me that something was up. How's it going to go 400 points on a word of some bailout? You know, something's up.
Yeah, well, that's basically the dealers being told that there's a fresh load of China White coming in tomorrow night.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. And so it's just sort of like, no, you know that's not solving the, you know, fundamental problem of it. I think that if they gave that money up, it just wouldn't work. I think that, you know, bailing out bankers is not where the stimulant should be going, you know. And one other thing, all of a sudden they can come up with this money. Why couldn't they pay $35 billion for some health care for kids?
Well, exactly.
And or
oh, but we were told, oh, we can't afford that. Oh, no. No.
$700 billion would cover every man, woman, and child for health care.
What we're spending on the bailout would pay for college for virtually every college-age person in this country.
Right.
I mean, I walk back into the main part of the house, and I look at little grandbabies, Sandra, and I look at that, you know, and how do I explain to a not-yet-2-year-old that she's on the hook for $2,000 for the rapacious greed and monstrous hate-filled avarice of the George Bush gang and his cronies? I don't have the skills to tell that to a 2-year-old yet.
No, I mean, the whole thing just stinks to the high heaven. And, you know, I can only hope that the natural tendency of gridlock will envelop this whole thing. You understand what I mean? Once it hits the Congress, things tend to come to a grinding halt, you know? And I don't care if the stock market drops, you know, 1,000 points. All the old people are in, lost every goddamn thing already, from what I can tell.
And the fact of the matter is, anything on Wall Street that still has real value will still have real value afterwards.
Oh, no. It needs to be corrected. I mean, you have these, you know, that AIG, is that the name of it? They had $80 for every dollar that they, in their assets, they had 80 worth of debt, like a half a trillion of debt. And $85 billion is supposed to do what? Nothing. It's a joke.
I know. Sandra, thank you. I appreciate your thoughts so very much. And, you know, just try not to let your head explode.
Oh, God, I won't. Anyway, listen, have a good evening.
Yeah, you too. Later.
Bye.
Bye. Sandra calling from Southern California. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm calling from the Front Range of the Rocky Mountains in Helena, Montana. This is Kate.
Yes. I figured as much.
You don't get many calls from Montana?
No, it's just anybody that can do your voice is, no. No, you're you.
All righty then. I have no idea. I just had an emergency call from Mississippi, so I haven't been streaming. So if I jump into the middle of the stream and muddy it up, then, you know, I'm
hey,
so
muddy,
sorry.
Muddy away. Muddy away. That's what streams are for.
And I have no idea where I'm going with this, so let's just wing it and enjoy the feathers, okay?
Okie doke.
I have a bit of an update from Mississippi, and even more so after the last 15 or 20 minutes on the phone. I've been in touch with Bryce at WQRZ ever since before the first storm blew in, before Gus blew in. And he was still having major political problems with the Board of Supervisors in Hancock County, and that's all out on the air now. He played the tape of the meeting with the guy that kicked him out of the EOC before the storm. And his trailer, I think I talked about this before, his trailer got melted in the storm surge, and so he's out of the FEMA camper, and he's got a borrowed camper until the fire season's over up here, and then when she gets back, she'll want her camper back. So Bryce is homeless, and you know, that's pretty much what's going on the coast all over. The storm surge they took, I don't know how much media coverage this is getting, but that part of Mississippi got some substantial damage just east of New Orleans. They got 12-foot storm surge with gusts and an 8-foot with Ike, and so that did melted a lot of things. It just a lot of paperwork and people's records
and you're pointing the way toward something that is worth expanding on and identifying. And that is the way that the horse race approach to politics in the so-called journalism in America has bled over into other areas of reportage. To wit, when a hurricane strikes, all we give a damn about is where the I crossed.
Yeah.
And we neglect the fact that the daggum Ike was 900 miles wide.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that there was an 8-foot storm surge on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. The only thing that would be surprising is that it was only an 8-foot storm surge.
Well, it was 12 with Gustav, but it was 8 with Ike, and so and what's so disheartening about that is that the Red Cross is out of money. There's no FEMA's pulled out and gone to Houston or Galveston, and which, you know, they should, but there are no resources left for Mississippi, none. And, you know, like the Red Cross is starting a new campaign and the bucket's empty. I mean, there are no resources. And all of the poor folks and the disabled people in Hancock County are completely devastated. And they're still living in shelters in the Lanyap Church, shelter that was put up for them, and it's just total devastation.
And it brings to mind the story, Kate, that Juanita sent me over the weekend that we referenced briefly last night in our conversation. This business FEMA has made a determination that hurricane and disaster victims no longer need FEMA to bring them ice.
Yeah.
And that is such a stunning display of either callous disregard or howling, mind-boggling ignorance. You know, there are medications out there that must be refrigerated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because a hurricane hits a little kid with a bad fever that needs an ice pack on his head doesn't become miraculously healed and not need the ice anymore.
Right. Well, they could get somebody to pray over him. The other big devastating piece of news is that, I mean, people don't even realize this, but people who are on life support systems like oxygen concentrators and all that, and they're running on generators, they're out of diesel, and they couldn't get fuel. And I haven't talked to Bryce for about 3 days, so I don't know what the conditions are, but it's pretty much of a mess there, not just in Galveston. I don't even know what's going on in Texas. I'm not paying any attention.
Paying any attention. You're not supposed to know. It's the whole news blackout.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, in fact, I think you can make the argument while it's a compelling story and it has ramifications for a lot of Americans, but I don't think nearly as many as is being led on, the bailout story was very, very convenient insofar as it diverted national attention away from the Texas Gulf Coast. Because it was a big one, but it was just a Category 2 storm. 115 miles an hour, you know, somewhere a little bit more than that maybe. But it was a Cat 2 storm, and it did worse. Worse or comparable damage to what a Cat 4 did to the Mississippi Gulf Coast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm just cynical that any time I hear a big story, I mean, I understand the economy thing is just devastating to people, and I understand that the fuel, the refineries are shutting down, and all we hear about is gas shortages, and, I mean, those are real, but this big story, and they keep going on and on and on, and people, unlikely people who don't know anything about economics, are talking and talking and talking and talking. That just tells me that our attention is being diverted from something more important, and something is going on out there that we don't know about. The Executive Order 51 is just laying there waiting to be instituted. And I heard a lady call in on Malloy one night, right after the storm, not right after, but like a week after, I don't know what the hell. She said, does anybody know what's going on in Houston? I mean, all we're hearing about is Galveston, and they're not talking about the people who are running out of diesel and the people who can't get back into their homes and for their generators and the medical problems and the lines around the block waiting to get ice and food. And nobody, is there any coverage of that on the air? And Mike said, no, I didn't know that. And I thought, wow. So in my ignorance, I found out that, you know, there's a complete blackout in parts of Texas, too. So I don't know. This is probably all old news if people are watching CNN or whatever. But anyway, I just wanted to let people know that Bryce is still on the air as of Sunday, and he's broadcast outside on his deck at the base of his transmitter shed. And he's got a webcam up that's going, and so he had to pull out on Friday because it started sprinkling and raining on him. And he said, hold on, I'm going to play some music. I got to move in because I'm going to get wet out here. So next webcam shot was the computer was gone, the chair had been turned around, the newspaper was gone, and he came back on the air, and the webcam's just sitting there staring at the empty deck. So, and another thing I'd like to share is that if people would go and stream, he got one more changer back up. He got it cleaned up and saved the music that was in it. It took him about 12, 15 volunteer hours to save the CDs in it, but he got the changer back up. So he's got three going now, and he's still got really, really good music on. And so if people, and he loves going to the counter and see that, you know, 27 or 52 or 580 people are streaming WQRZ. So That's a kind of an energy boost and emotional support for him. So I would encourage people, if they need some background music or whatever, to go and stream WQRZ.org. And it's a good boost for him. So, but I just got a telephone call. I was late. That's why I was late checking in from Mississippi. And she said, Kate, where are you? And I said, I'm in Montana. And she said, I just woke up crying this morning thinking I gotta call her, but I ain't gonna because she's got her own life to live and whatever. So I wasn't gonna leave on the 10th, and I think I'm probably gonna leave on the 25th on Friday night and drag up and head for the Big River and get back there, because what's going on in Jackson County is that the office that I worked in before has to go out to all of their cases and tell them, you can't live here. You're just going to have to, we have no resources for you. You make $600 a month on Social Security, and you've got, there's no way you can live here.
What if they happen? What, you know, there are a million, but there are a million questions that go with that, Kate. What happens if the people who live on $600 a month happen to own the little postage stamp chunk, size chunk of ground that their house is or was on? They got to leave anyway?
Well, they can build, they can rebuild. But there's no rebuild money.
Okay, I'm not going to ask the stupid question.
Well, it's all being really well taken care of up in Jackson. I mean, it's in a really nice account, earning, I think I'm going to step out here and say probably $10,000 a day in interest or a week, I don't know, but enough that it choked me. I don't even like to remember the number.
But what's it being saved for? Somebody's got to get it sooner or later. I mean,
you'd have to ask Mr. Barber's office that. I don't know. They got new port facilities in Ocean Springs and Gulfport.
Well, that's true. I heard that,
and I guess the
casinos are doing land office business, I suppose.
I reckon they got a little bit of subsidized money from the state tourist Part Bureau or something. I don't know. I really try to stay out of those politics because all I can do is just go help whatever. But she said, so I think I'm probably not going to the Mississippi Center for Justice. I'm going back to my original office because she's hired, FEMA has taken over the case management, and she's hired some new case managers, but there's tons and tons of paperwork and grunt work to do. She said, I know you love to do that, so I'm just needing somebody in the office, but I don't want to ask because I know you've got your own life. And I said, well, no, my life is negotiable. I can drag up any time. That's why I'm almost on wheels. I can do anything I want to. So I'm going to be heading out to the Big River on Friday evening, and that'll be that. So this is just like an audio postcard.
Well, I hope we keep getting them. I want to hear your impressions when you first get back down there, because first impressions are most usually the most valid. And you're gonna know the minute you take a look around. You're gonna have probably the best idea of the time that you're down there. You'll have the best idea right then of what you're up against.
Yeah, that's what I do when I get down. Is I drive back to the grandpa's house where the garbage pile stayed for months and months and months, and the rats and snakes were a little bit annoying to him. And another lady to see if she's got a roof on yet and that kind of thing. I can pretty much tell by driving around the old neighborhoods and checking out the places I'm familiar with, who's out of the trailer, whose trailer got towed away, whatever. But what she told me was that she needs to be going out with the case managers who are new to the area, new to the people. She needs to accompany them out on the calls when they have to tell them that there are no more resources for you. And she said, the look, they've got the look on their face. I know you don't like the word clients, but the people who are the survivors have got the look. And I said, the one of hopelessness and despair? And she said, yeah. So my assumption is that the suicide rates of domestic violence is going to increase. Alcoholism, I mean, alcohol-related crimes and stuff are going to increase. Kids are getting rowdier. The feral packs of kids running the streets at night in Pascagoula are going to be on the upswing, and it's a mess, you know. So all I can do is just show up and go to Miss Exie's house and tell her she owes me a meal of black-eyed peas. That's what I'm waiting for.
and they'll be as fine as you could ever hope to get.
That's right. I have to go to the store first and get a mess of greens and some dead pig and take them over to her. And then
see everything you're talking about. And I guess at this point in time, I should probably realize that there's always going to be a serial quality to this program. It goes back to that David Foster Wallace stuff I was reading last night about default.
Oh, that was stunning. Oh, it was stunning. Yeah.
About default positions. You know, you're actively fighting the default, you know, the default settings in your own soul, to haul out an overworked word like soul.
Right.
You're able to recognize, and what I'm getting at is this isn't why you're doing it, but you become a better human being by virtue of what you're doing on the Gulf Coast and basically what you do everywhere you go, because I happen to know that you haven't just been indolently toddling across Montana. So, you know, you're actively...
Oh, no.
But if you took... I mean, just let me throw a hypothetical out there for you.
Oh, get hypothetical on me.
I'm hyper-pathetical. I might even engage in a... I might even engage in a little bit of hyperbole.
No, that's my job, son.
Okay, but what if you took, say, this clown from AIG or the clown from Lehman Brothers, and gave them both a pair of painter's pants and bib overalls to change into when the painter's pants got dirty, and said, "Fellas, it's time to meet real life," and sent them down to, they can pick, Mississippi Gulf Coast, Louisiana, Texas Gulf Coast, and say, "Welcome to humanity, fellas. Get with it." You reckon they would be bettered, or are they too far gone?
Well, I got some experience with that. Not those particular kind of people, but people who my first response is, oh, shit, no. Keep them away. They need too much supervision. They're dangerous with power tools. They think they know everything. They fight with all the volunteers, and they, you know, they want to be the boss when the construction super is just, you know, going crazy. And, yeah, I've worked with those people who they even came for to do humanitarian work, and they get there and think, oh, well, I don't really want to do this. I'd rather be the boss, you know. And so, yeah, there's some habitat homes going up here in Helena, and the guy said to me, there's a hammer that'll fit your hand. And I said, no, I'm feeling guilty. I'll probably swing by, and I was going to this week, but I'm leaving now, so I won't. But he's having trouble with his volunteers because a lot of them want to be boss, you know. So
nobody, yeah, everybody wants to be the chief, and nobody wants to be an Indian.
I would want those people to just come and hang out without ice in August, and so, you know, I wouldn't want them picking up the tools. They need too much supervision, so you can keep those folks away. Extend the hyperbole. Never mind. Yeah, I understand the point you're making, though, and I guess I don't care much about other people's souls. Those guys, there's a special place in heaven for them and whatever. I'm not following this economy thing too close because it's all smoke and mirrors, and there's something big this way is coming. And you asked for callers to call in yesterday about something about what it, I wasn't poking a stick at you when I emailed yesterday about leave the pitchforks. We need the pitchforks for picking up the cow manure and the compost, because not to go after the, you know, whatever. And I'm feeling you wanted to know what it's going to look like after the crash or after the whatever. And, it's just got to be an attitude thing. We just have to. Wow, I wasn't even going to get into this all.
That's okay. Go there.
I wasn't, somebody noted last night, I heard somebody say that the dip happened, and all the towns stayed the same, all the buildings stayed the same, all the businesses stayed the same. There just wasn't any money, but there wasn't any money out in Iowa to begin with, you know, and people made it, and they got by, and they did what they had to do, and they went on, you know, and then the government came in and did their deal, and the 80s happened, and Reagan came and did his deal, and it's just so much manipulation. And where's your water? Is there a well? Is there an electric pump on it? Do you have a hand pump for the well? I mean, where's your food, and where's your relatives? Where's your loved ones?
And see, there's such beauty in what you ask there, because when I got that email last night, Kate, I turned around and I looked back into the next room, and our well's back there. And right now it has an electric pump in it and little bolts that are sealing it. But you know what?
Right.
I could take the bolts off, and I could haul out the pump, and then I could drop that old zinc galvanized,
That's right.
Ever seen one. It's a column, and it's got a hook in the top.
Yeah.
And you drop it.
Yeah.
And you hear it go,
yeah,
whack-a-da, 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 all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hear it go.
Mm-hmm.
And after it does that, you wait for a couple of minutes, and then you'll hear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know that it's full. And you get, and you put your hands on the handle, and you start turning. And a couple of minutes later, you haul up 2 gallons of ice-cold, beautiful, brilliant, crystal-clear water.
Well, I was going to email you privately and ask if you've got a bucket for your well, because if you don't, the electric is not going to do you any. The electric pump's not going to do any good. So I always want to know from people, do you have a bucket for that well? No, we got a pump. No, you don't. Pretend you don't have a pump. Now
you don't have to pretend. I mean, your power will be anywhere on the industrialized grid. You're going to be out of power for a couple of days at any given time anywhere in America.
And folks just don't think about things like that, and I do. I guess I've been doing this since the late 90s and working on sustainable communities and stuff, and people look at me like I'm weird, and I say, okay, fine, you know.
Now, see, not too awfully long back, a few months or so, there was a little bit of a seminar put on down the Coal River Valley on permaculture. And I didn't get to go, but everyone who participated in it said it was a life-changing experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And see, we've got a fancy name for it now. We call it permaculture.
Mm-hmm.
But for those who are inclined to do so, it's also known as how we used to live.
Yeah. So, and some people aren't up to that, and they don't need to be, and, you know, they have other resources and whatever, but I just always ask people, where's your water, where's your food, and where's your loved ones, and that kind of narrows it down to, oh, well, maybe, I don't know. So anyway, I need to, I think I'm still running on last month's cell minutes, and I'm having to use them for Mississippi, so I wanted to just check in with an outdated update. I'm glad you're back on the air, but it's hard to get to you sometimes, son.
Well, I know. You know, the week in Berea was very well spent, but then last week was kind of weird, you know, on again, off again kind of thing. And I've still got the thing going on with the boys' football. I don't know if he's going to be playing this week. He's got the stomach virus that's going around. And it's icky. So I don't know if he's going to play Thursday. If he doesn't, I'll be here. If he does, I won't. I'm definitely out the door on Saturday or Friday for some seminar purposes. Yeah, so just trying to spread the word.
The next audio postcard you get from me then will be sometime in the mid country. I'll be going probably out through Wyoming and across to, I wanted to do Minnesota, and Wisconsin maybe, and then drop straight south through, I don't know, but I'm not going to do Arkansas and Texas this year. Those obligatory visits are out of the question this time. I'm going to just head
shoot across and hit I-55 and go south.
Mm-hmm. Where does 55 go?
Runs straight down the west bank of the Mississippi River.
Oh. I'm trying to get east of the river, the big river.
Well, you can cross it anywhere you want to. You can cross it at Memphis. You can cross it at runs straight down. You know, shoot across, pick up I-55 anywhere west of the river, and down you go. And, shot past Texas and all of that stuff.
Yeah, well, whatever. So the next audio postcard you'll be getting from me will be someplace back there, back yonder, and I'll check in when I've got something important to say. And in the meantime, y'all take care, and I'll be, I'll keep it between the ditches, keep the flat side down, greasy side down.
All right. Yeah, what is it? Greasy side down, shiny side up. For Roger.
It's like, that's cool. It's not traveling. How do you like your eggs? All right. I'll check in. Hug the redhead for me, will you?
Oh, I sure will. And you stay as safe as you can.
I do. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye now. Okay. Let's see what's going on here. Okay. So I think it's probably at roughly 13 and a half minutes past the hour. It's okay if we take a little break. Why the heck not? Just a short one, a little musical interlude, something vaguely reminiscent. I think you'll enjoy it. What the heck? You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn. Conversation is the name of the game. The phone number is 877-443-2366, 877 the numeral 4, head on, or on your own nickel, 304-658-3333. It all rings in the same place. Take them as they come. We'll be right back.
Wash your face, picks up the Herald and sees the face of Zelda Fitzgerald. She's part of the scene of life between the wars. The tropic sun is sticky and warm, and it bakes the head
of Somerset mom who is writing a scene of life between the wars. You're waiting by the hot dog stand in the onion air as the bomb flies through the park. Violet and Vito run through the streets of Paris, their laughter floating through the dark. A fog that fell is swallowing London. Coco Chanel came back with a suntan to brighten the scene of life between the wars.
Children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Well, dadgummit, it is the second hour. See, we're careful with our language. We just don't say that it's the start of the second hour, I don't think. Did we? No, we didn't. We're well into the second hour of tonight's program, and I've got a little something I wanted to mention to you. It's not very often that we get to offer a lot of stuff because, you know, we do scramble to survive, and it doesn't leave a lot of room for funsies, if you will. But after the rally for Green Jobs and Healthy Mountains. And I hope you got to hear the audio of that on the weekend stream. I did put it up there. You got to hear the reality of the rally, even if you weren't there. I'm going to go ahead and also post it. I'll ask Ben to post it at whiterosesociety.org so y'all can hear what happened a week ago in Charleston at the Capitol. Because this effort's not over. The rally in Charleston was not the end of things. It is the beginning of things. And as such, the support for the Coal River Wind Project is needed as much now as it has ever been. And if you will be so kind as to send me an email. And in the email, if you will put your mailing address, and I promise not to abuse it, if you'll put your email address in that email, I will send you a beautiful, gorgeous, right out there button. Keep it as a keepsake, or more importantly, put it on whatever you're wearing out that day and show your support for the beginnings of Green America. You see, we have this financial crisis, so-called, going on because so much of Wall Street was heavily invested in BS. Far more than any bailout would ever do, the salvation of the American economy is in the move toward so-called green jobs, sustainable jobs, jobs that support a renewable economy. And at the forefront of all of that is the Coal River Mountain Wind Project. So just if you're hearing it, if you're listening live, or if you are listening later by some podcast archive or on the rerun stream, shoot me an email with your mailing address on it, and I'll send you, because the my friends down at Coal River Mountain Watch thought you all would like to have these. This isn't some sort of, you know, make a donation to the horn and I'll send you a button kind of thing. No, it's not that. We can always use your contributions, but there is no quid pro quo involved. I would, I want to see you, who have been so valiant in your efforts to support this literally life-changing project. I'd like you to have some memento of it so that, you know, you can wear it out to the gas station, grocery store, post office, what have you. And say, "What's that?" And away you go. So shoot me an email. Give me your mailing address, not your email address, your snail mail address. And Agnes and I will sit and stuff envelopes with Coal River Wind buttons. Tell me how many you need. One for every member of the family? That's okay. I mean, I don't have an unlimited supply, but you are, you know, I can spare two or three per envelope. Do it. And I hope you will, and I hope you will help us get this message out. ColeRiverWind.org. You know, that's the way it begins. Hey, what in the world is that? ColeRiverWind.org. You want to know what that is? You go to ColeRiverWind.org, and you'll find out. And then you start, you tell them what it is. It's part of that old theory that you tell them what you're going to do, you do it, and then you tell them what you did. This is how that works. ColeRiverWind.org. You can educate yourself. But this button, it's a beautiful four colors, sky blue, grass green, black print, and white outlining. Big old button, too. Support Coal River Wind. Just let me know, and they are certainly yours for the asking. And let's take a quick look in the email box. Okay, see, I'm getting straightened up. This comes in from a listener. And like I said, that when the inclination to go burn baby burn or let it go, I recognize that it's juvenile and it is ill-advised. But that's what comes of an America that watches Wall Street advance itself to the detriment of so many. Let it crash. Let it go. Or maybe force it to crash. This is the email. Force it to crash. And I said, inside my tiny noggin, that's what I think. Didn't I hear that? If you really want the market to crash, if you do, you want me to lose 48 grand. I've already lost 10 grand. I kept it a job for 40-plus years for a reason. I have no other savings. I understand that you're part of a very different economic system and have been for years. You have nothing to lose in personal monetary terms. I do, having put mine in that account after I took it out of my paycheck to create the balance. You, however, are playing with house money. The safe guards against most fraud can be put in without a crash. You took a very easy and obvious path to a position on this. You could have done better. It hurts me to hear you being so comfortable or maybe even wishing me ruined financially, even though you do it in your glib, gifted, and gregarious manner. No, that's not what I did at all. That's why I've been asking. That is why I've been asking for two solid nights. What does a post-crash America look like? And I don't know, we've posited a few attempts, but I don't know if any of us really, really, really knows what it looks like. There's what it looks like. 48 grand. Everything in the world. Poof. Now, my problem is that, yeah, they'll eat that 48 grand. But you know what? There was a myth in 1929 of brokers on the ledges jumping. And that's all it was, a myth. If it happened, it happened very, 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 on very few occasions. The fat cats didn't bust. Oh, that, you know, that their lifestyles contracted a little bit, but they didn't bust. No, don't think for an instant that I don't know what a crash means. Because I never met the man. He died 3 years before I was born. But I had a grandmother. I had an aunt. I had a mother and an uncle who could tell me about the life difference of a young man who was devastated by a crash. And there was no bailout for him. There was no bailout at all. There wasn't a bailout for anybody out this road. I'm part of a very different economic system and have been for years. I don't think you could call what I'm involved in an economic system. I got plenty to lose. We tend to forget that in times of financial crisis, if money gets scarce, and that's what it really means, that's why I keep asking this question. What does a post-crash America look like? That's why I keep saying things like, in 1929, they shut the factories, but in 2009, which is coming, 80 years later, there are no factories to close. What does a post-crash America look like, and do you really want it? I sit here and I ask these sincerely put questions, and they are assumed to be positions. That's why last night I said that I had an inkling, not an understanding, but an inkling of why people who were being devastated were willing to stand there in Watts and say, burn, baby, burn. Because it is a visceral reaction. But I don't kid myself. I know what happens in an all-out meltdown. I know what happens in an all-out crash. On a most immediate level, all this that we're doing here, all this that we've built, all this that we have tried to accomplish, even though we're not heavily invested in the market or anything like that, by God, there is a hell of an investment, and I can tell you that any day of the week. Everybody who moderates a chat room, everybody who blogs or looks for news stories and does all the behind the scenes works that makes this sound so darned easy, are leveraged to the hilt, so to speak, in what's going on here. No, I'm not playing on Wall Street because, well, frankly, I don't play in Vegas either. Don't play in Atlantic City. The closest I come to gambling is the $2 twice a week that I plunk down on the lottery. But certain assumptions get made based on what I say. Okay, this thought. Even if you grant that this really is a crisis and that it justifies an extraordinary intervention, there can be no doubt that the $700 billion authority being sought for the purchase of distressed mortgage-related securities is far too great an amount. Well, that there's an element of truth in that, because the $700 billion is not just going for mortgages. It really is a bailout. It's not just the bad mortgages and the phony baloney scams that were put forward over the last several years. The people seeking the bailout themselves say that they want to be able to protect against investments of questionable value. Yeah, here's the numbers. Of the $1.26 trillion in non-prime mortgages, that is, subprime and Alt-A mortgages, $743 billion is already either owned or guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, companies that were shored up by a government rescue earlier this month. That leaves $521 billion, which means the Treasury's $700 billion would be more than enough to buy them all. And that's even if the Treasury paid full value. In fact, the Treasury will get a steep discount, considering that many of the mortgages in question... See, I'm reading, and I haven't gotten the rest yet. But you get the idea. The mortgage, considering that many of the mortgages in question are in delinquency or default, does the Treasury really have to buy every single non-prime mortgage, even the healthy ones, twice over? I haven't taken an easy or an obvious path on this. There is no easy or no obvious. Just because, see, I do know by virtue of the history that was handed down to me that by virtue of the, the market crashed in 1929, and my grandfather wasn't in the market. Farmers across America weren't in the market. All kinds of Americans weren't in the market, and they took it harder than anybody else. People lost homes to taxes because there was not enough money to get them to the assessor's office to pay the annual tax bill. People lost thousands of dollars in value for want of the ability to pay property taxes. I comprehend a lot more of this than maybe I'm being given credit for. Oh, yeah, the money's disappearing. And it's hard to wrap your mind around, isn't it? How do you have 58 grand one day, and a year later it's 48 grand? I remember reading that wonderful book many years ago called The Wealthy Barber that was all about the glories of compounded interest and long-term invest and hold strategies. And supposedly, if you do that, you weather the storm and you get it all back. But that doesn't work for retired America. That doesn't work for baby boom America, because the realistic chances of being around to get it back are nil. So I ask the question again. What does a post-crash America look like? And I'm not asking for your speculation on, you know, whether or not they board up the mall. What does a post-crash America look like? What's in the faces of the people? What happens to them? Wish financial ruin? Never. Because, frankly, again, you may not, if you're invested in the market, yeah, you'll lose that money. If you're not invested in the market, you will lose whatever you have to lose. See, that's the beauty of this scam. You're going to carry it. You're going to carry the Wall Street suits. Because they're not going to lose. They never do. The house never loses. Bankruptcy? Corporate bankruptcy means corporate bankruptcy reorganization. When the bankruptcy, bankruptcy reform was passed a few years back, they didn't touch corporate bankruptcy laws. That was all designed to keep you from being able to declare bankruptcy after a devastating illness that caused you to run up a bunch of credit card debt or medical bill debt. I know that crap firsthand. I was with my father for a significant period of time, long about late 1996, early 1997, when he lived on credit cards in a hotel room in Birmingham, Alabama, while the University of Alabama Birmingham Medical Center was performing a radical coverage ectomy on my mother. And my father would have sooner eaten poop than declared bankruptcy. But you know what? Should have. But now, somebody else similar to the situation that my father was in can't declare bankruptcy. Lehman went bankrupt. Lehman will come back. How many times, ask yourself, how many times has Donald Trump gone bankrupt? The answer, a lot. Trying really hard not to be upset by this note. The safeguards against most fraud can be put in without a crash. Yeah, you're right. They absolutely can. But we don't get the safeguards against fraud without my not quite 2-year-old sucking up $2,000 worth of debt and my grandson, who's not done sucking on bottles yet, sucking up another $2,000. Every kid on the school bus this morning sucking up $2,000. Me sucking up $2,000. You sucking up $2,000. Everybody, every single person in this country, red, yellow, white, black, brown, eating $2,000 for George Bush and a bunch of silk suits on Wall Street. I'm playing with house money. Somebody show me where the damn safe is. Because we struggle to stay alive. Every month, every week, every day. No, I'm not playing with any house money. Because, again, the house never loses. And we've got plenty to lose. And that's why I describe it as juvenile and visceral and lizard-brained. When I talk about the inclination to just let it go. Because the sober reflection is that if it is let go, it's not going to be let go, and no, there won't be, like I said, any brokers on the ledges because they know the fix is in. If you're the CEO of a Wall Street bank, the fix is always in. From the first moment that Alexander Hamilton proposed a national bank of the United States, the fix for Wall Street has always been in. The difference in a crash to one of the Wall Street high atmospheric dwellers is the difference between the steak 7 nights a week and steak 3 nights a week. The calculus is much more devastating to those of us who breathe the air at lower levels. Me wish anybody financially ruined? Not hardly. Not hardly. See, if you go back and you comprehend the Reagan 80s, you know the plunder that went on. See, the better portions, to the extent you can use a word like better, of the Reagan administration were financed on the backs of working people's money. That's why pensions were converted into IRAs and 401ks and flimflams and things that could be put into the market and played with. Nobody was given a choice. Oh, it's going to be great. You're going to have a Roth IRA, and then it's tax-free while you're getting blah, blah, blah. You know, there's still a tax bill when you cash the damn thing in. Nope, I have nothing to lose. I have nothing to lose. I don't have 5 years of blood, sweat, and tears at this to lose. I don't have a wife to lose. I don't have 4 children to lose. I don't have a son-in-law to lose. I don't have grandchildren to lose. I don't have a home to lose. Well, hell, let's just put on freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Sunshine, I ain't free. I ain't free at all. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. This is Juanita.
Hey, Juanita.
My daddy was like you. He was a lot, and he was funny, and he talked a lot about what they went through. And I don't know if you want me to tell some of that or not.
Go right ahead.
I'll tell you a little. It wasn't the Vikings. I never did like that show because those people would have been rich. But for instance, my daddy, one time he got a job. They'd take any jobs they could get. And one time he got a job of canning lamb outside. And do you know what gnats are?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Okay, I didn't know if they were up your way or not. But anyway, he hardly had any clothes. His shoes were wired together, and his pants, he didn't have any underpants, and his pants had little holes in them, and the gnats started swarming around while he was working. And he'd make you laugh about it. You know, you always laugh about things like that.
Sure.
And he'd tell that the net went in and out of the window. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
And one time the shoes, like he had the shoes wired together, and he didn't have any groceries, didn't have anything to cook for breakfast or anything, and who got a job at a funny thing, a welfare office, and I know what you mean, like your dad didn't want to do bankruptcies or nothing.
Right.
Of course, back then, if you got welfare, it might have been $2 or $3 a month.
Yeah, right. And back then, there were still county work farms, weren't there?
I don't know about that.
Yeah,
he worked for that. WPA or whatever.
Yeah, there was the WPA, and which was the Works Progress Administration. And then there was the CCC, which was the Civil Conservation Corps.
The difference between Hoover and Roosevelt, it's not that there weren't hard times after Roosevelt came in, you know, still.
In many ways, they got harder.
There was two differences. He gave them hope, and he did something. He took action, and he gave hope. Better, you know, after he came in. But one time, and he got this job, he went, there's a welfare office over in about 2 miles from where I lived. And he went in and asked, was any kind of work that they could find for him to do? And said he needed something to eat and for, you know, family. And so anyway, they said there was a lot, you know, that was all grown up that he could clean, and they would give him money to buy some groceries for that. And he said that they gave him a sandwich, and he said it tasted like Octagon soap. I don't think you know what
I. I remember Octagon soap too.
Okay. That was a.
I got my mouth washed out with it once.
Yeah. Anyway, then. He got out there, and it was real hot. He was working, and he said he ate that sandwich, and he said, like he said, it tasted, and he started getting sick. And he talked to him, said his name was Frank. He said, now, Frank, you can't throw that up. That's the only food you're going to get. You got to stay working, you know. So anyway, and of course, he had those shoes wired together. So then at the end of the day, he got through, and they paid him, and he went to the grocery store, and back then what you get was like a bag of flour, fried bacon, some lard. You know, that would be your regular, because you didn't have any refrigeration.
Right, and that's enough to get you most of the way toward bacon and biscuits.
Right, and anyway, then on the way home, his shoes fell apart. Just, I don't know, but there's things like that. In other words, you don't have what you have.
No.
You know, and back then you didn't have a 40-hour week if you found something. It was at least 6 days a week, at least. And it was like 12-hour days, and maybe you would make a dollar a day, maybe, or less.
Right.
And down here in Florida, he was able to buy a home for $500, because at one time the land down here had been worth more probably than it has become now. And they had a big bust in the 20s. So it was a, you know, two-bedroom, one-bath house. And had running water, too. He'd never had running water. And this was after Roosevelt was in and all. And he was able to buy that, and it had three lots, and it took about as long as it would to pay off the house today. Because, you know, you could hardly find any work in the summertime. Very seldom. So they worked, like down in here, they worked in citrus. And you had to walk to work. You know, that's just the way it was.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that give you an idea or not. I know some other stuff. But
well, and see, you're talking, Juanita, about some of the same stuff that I heard.
And the question
that I'm asking, the reason I asked it was not rhetorical. But it was a question of, if you want to say let it all go and let it crash, then there are real world consequences, and there are human consequences. There are hospitals that close. There are the school systems that collapse. there are, because there's nobody that hasn't been sucked into Wall Street, with very few exceptions. And even those who have not been sucked into Wall Street will feel firsthand the effects of Wall Street. The problem, however, lies in the fact that, well, I've got a thing here from Paul Krugman. And, you know, I trust him as a pretty smart character.
Yeah, I like him.
And there's a little phrase here that should be paid very, very close attention to. And I'll just read it real quick, Juanita.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about Senator Dodd's alternate proposal for the bailout plan.
Yeah.
He says he's had more time to read it. He says it's much better than the Paulson plan. And frankly, no plan is better than the Paulson plan.
Right.
But he says the key feature, I believe, is the equity participation. If Treasury buys assets, it gets warrants that can be converted into equity if the price of the purchased assets falls. This both guarantees against a pure bailout of the financial firms, and here's the important part, and opens the door to a real infusion of capital if that becomes necessary, and I think it will.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what Paul Krugman is saying is that if the bailout plans are under the best of circumstances, if the bailout plans are put in place, it's still gonna crash.
Okay.
And that's why I said last night that none of these plans are related to keeping the market from crashing.
Mm-hmm.
These plans are related to keep the market from crashing until January 20th. As is always the case with a member of the Bush family, all they're concerned with is making sure that no responsibility sticks to them. For a party that preaches personal responsibility, the Bush family is the single most irresponsible cabal in this country, and I include crackheads in that equation. So, it seems to me, if I read it correctly, Paul Krugman, by saying that a real infusion of capital is going to be necessary, is saying that $500 billion, $700 billion, if you do it, you're still going to have to save the market because it's going to go. Now, the question is, what do you do if you're sitting here now and you've got... Paul Krugman is nobody to sneeze at. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
If Paul Krugman is telling you it's going to go, what do you do? Is it time to stuff the mattress with money?
Yeah.
Or do you leave it there and let the Wall Street guy say, well, you know, granted, we've shown you that there is a break on the roulette wheel, but let's spin again. What do you say? You know, I'm not advocating a run on the bank, but Lord, how do you approach this? Do you sit there and take that that buy and hold approach and just hope that the market gets well?
Yeah. Well, I don't think they can be trusted with that money, with no strings attached.
Oh, I know, and that is why Paulson was in front of Congress today, telling them to not believe their lying ears.
Yeah.
I don't know if you caught any of it, Juanita.
No, I didn't.
But there he sits. He sits there in front of the, well, here, I got the audio. He sits there in front of the hearing today, and does this little song and dance.
And let me give you another ad hoc comment there. When we all met Thursday night, as you'll recall, Chairman, with the leaders of Congress, you all said to us, don't give us a fait accompli. Come in and work with us. We gave you a simple 3-page legislative outline, and I thought it would have been presumptuous for us on that outline to come up with an oversight mechanism. That's the role of Congress. That's something we're going to work on together.
So, in other words, that Section 8 the garbage that he put forward about how he was going to get to spend $700 billion all by his little old lonesome self, and that no court could intervene and no one could oversee what he was doing, he didn't really mean that. What he meant was... Yeah, that's what... Yeah. Oh, no, that was a direct... What you just heard was his response to why is there no oversight. And he says, well, yeah, I want oversight. I just, you know, I didn't tell you about it because I felt like it would be presumptuous.
You don't want it written in the
bill, though. Yeah, it would be presumptuous of me to tell you I wanted oversight. Horse feathers. But, you know, the problem right now is, you know, you don't put the brakes on a runaway vehicle 2 feet before it hits the wall. And if I read Paul Krugman correctly, he's saying it's going to hit it's all going to hit the wall.
Mhm. Well, the way they so-called manage money, you can count on it, I believe.
But I mean, I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at the very real possibility of you know, losing this place. It's not immediate, but if everything shakes out the way it shook out in 1929, and frankly 1929 may actually have been comparatively easier because we had something to build back up. The offshore gang has made sure that
yeah,
doesn't exist.
Yeah, I know a few of the differences just for survival. You know, you could go fishing and...
Yep, can't eat the fish.
Fishing with biting, but now you got to have a license.
Well, but not just that. You can't eat the fish because of all the mercury we pumped into the air thanks to coal-fired power plants.
And then down here you used to could go and get food out of the grove. Now you can get shot.
Yeah, and then there's, you know,
under the jail or something.
All the world's fisheries have been overfished or 75% overfished around the world. That's tuna, that's mackerel, that's snapper, that's everything.
Yeah. If they climbed work, they were doing all right. You know, they had to work long hours and all, but they were thankful for it. You know, and that's what makes me mad when Bush and all them get up and say, you know, American people won't do these jobs. Well... The one they're not offered down, a lot of them aren't offered down here because they've relied on trucking in these people that from the other countries that they make slaves out of. And, you know, and that's been going on a long time. And it's people like Harris and Adam Putnam, you know, they got their citrus families, and you can basically, they earned it like, hey, my daddy picked fruit. They worked in the fruit, you know, they worked in the groves and all. And I know a lot of people that will do that even now, you know, Americans, believe it or not. But, do you remember when McCain got up and said, you people wouldn't work for that? You know, this was before, I don't know if he was run for president then or not. And people said, yes, we would. He said, if I paid you $50 an hour, you wouldn't last a week, and they said, give us a chance. And it's like, he couldn't believe it. A lot of people love to do that kind of work, too.
Well,
$50 an hour. But he couldn't believe it. These people have no concept of what you can do. And a lot of these jobs, I've worked on business jobs where I had to clean the windows, and I had to... Practically, you know, climb ladders and different things like that, doing different things. And, you know, it's not just, you're sitting there and just diddling around waiting for the phone to ring. There's a lot of things that you have to do that is very physical. They don't tell you about it when you apply.
No.
But you know what I'm saying? It's American people work hard.
We're the hardest working of any nation, any so-called first world nation.
Yeah.
We're actually a third world nation. It's just that nobody can bear to look at it.
I would like for somebody to ask him, is he still offering those $50 an hour jobs? But anyway, well, God bless our parents for going through it. But I'll tell you one more thing. He said that another difference than when Hoover was in, he said it's not knocking Hoover. I guess he was a good man, just didn't know what to do. But I don't know. But anyway, he said that if it had stayed that way, he'd have thought him and a lot other people would probably starve to death.
Yes, and that's the thing. People did starve to death. No matter how hard, no matter what the effort, there were people who starved to death.
Yeah.
Herbert Hoover was a good man. I don't know. You know,
I don't know either, right, but my daddy didn't think so.
Well, I'll give you an example.
Better than I did.
I'll give you an example, Juanita, of what a good man Herbert Hoover was. Long about 1927? No. It was before Hoover became president. Maybe it was 1919, something like that. But before Hoover became president, there was a hellacious hurricane that struck the Gulf Coast, the Mississippi River Delta.
Oh, boy.
And Herbert Hoover helped shore up the levees. And he did it with the labor of African Americans who were chained together.
From the prisons.
Not necessarily from the prisons.
Oh.
But if a levee failed, they all drowned, and a lot did. But it was okay.
Yeah.
You know, that's the Republican approach. You know what?
When they had the tent? I think it was the veterans went up there and they pitched tents. And he had MacArthur to go out there.
Oh, yeah, that was Coxey's army, wasn't it? Or the bonus army.
I don't know what, but it was, they didn't get anything. You know, there's a lot of stuff like that went on. And it was really, slavery is not dead. It's just got a different form.
Sure. It didn't die in 1865. It was just transformed into the sharecropping system.
It's all kind of stuff, Bob. Yeah. I tell you, it's something. It's a deep subject, and I believe you and I have been fortunate enough to have that passed along, because a lot of people just can't believe some of the stuff that went on.
See, there are different ways that. Well, I heard about mustard sandwiches.
Oh, yeah. Mayonnaise sandwiches?
Sure.
That reminds me of, these cinnamon buns.
Mm-hmm.
You used to get a big old package for a nickel. And people call that lifesavers because it would fill your stomach up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Lifesavers.
But,
that's what they're calling down here.
This calls for some strategic... If we're going to call it a crisis, it calls for some strategic, creative thoughts.
Oh,
those retirement funds that were mentioned in that email. Instead of bailing out, say, Goldman Sachs or any of these huge houses or any of these huge banking houses, what do you say that we bail out not just the people who have crisis mortgages? But what would be wrong with guaranteeing retirement funds? You know that. What would be wrong with that? Granted, if you're a Wall Streeter, what's wrong with that is that it doesn't guarantee your paycheck.
Yeah.
Because these Wall Street goons, screw America, we're getting ours first. You know, there's a story out, and of course it has to come out of an overseas newspaper. This is from the Independent in the UK, from yesterday. Up to 10,000 staff at the New York offices of the bankrupt investment house Lehman Brothers are going to share a bonus pool that was set aside for them worth $2.5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And, why not? You know, the bonus pool was set aside before they declared bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. Of course it was. So it was, you know, so.
If that's cheating, if we went bankrupt to do that as individuals, that would be holding back.
Yeah, and the.
You'd be fined and go to prison.
And this is only coming out because Barclays Bank in the UK is buying Lehman Brothers. And the workers, the Barclays workers in the UK are absolutely, they got blood in their eyes. They're so enraged. Uh-huh. They're furious.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to tell you, some of these people, like, from California.
Oh, Sandra?
Sandra, forgive me for forgetting your name, because I think you're great. But anyway, she brought up about, wasn't it somebody, they beat up their boss because he's laying up?
No, they killed him.
They killed him?
They beat him to death.
Well, these people that are acting so high and mighty, they better watch their step. And you know that, not for me, because I don't have a job, but... you know, people are going to pack so much, and some of them are going to break quicker than others. I think a lot of people in this country already have. But anyway, they, you know, those veterans, I don't think you read that email yet about the veterans are up there protesting.
Yeah, and here in a little bit, I hope before the show's over to give one of them a call.
One of them a call?
Yeah, I'm going to give them a call.
Well, that would be great. But see, I heard the one talking about it, and he said, we try to be, this guy was asking the most stupid questions. I sent you, to get that little one, you know, they got a bunch of them, but this is one. And he said, we've tried being nice, we've tried doing the right things, and he said, it just doesn't work. So now I think they're going to start getting attention. And I say, God bless them.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
See, what you've done, Juanita, is you have pointed out the real world effects that come with all this, because I started seeing stuff about a year ago when you'd walk through a great big chain grocery store that used to have, you know, there was never a blank spot on the shelves.
Right.
Well, now there are more and more blank spots.
Right, I know.
The fact of the matter is, it doesn't matter if you're invested. It doesn't matter if you have a position in the market. When there aren't any beans on the grocery store shelf, you go hungry.
Of course.
You see what I'm saying? So, you know, that's...
Yeah, they've got the water tied up, too.
I was really resisting the idea of saying, well, it's going to be like this, 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 and this, because I'm not, you know, I'm not some fortune teller.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I'm trying to, you know...
No, but you can see the signs a lot of times.
Well, you kind of can. But, you know, you've listened to your fair share, Juanita, of right-wing radio. They get on the air, the Limbaughs and the Bortzes and the Hannitys and the O'Reillys and that filthy crowd. And they don't ask people to think. They tell them what to think.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and that's the profound difference as compared to, generally speaking, to liberal radio. And so what I've been trying to do for 2 days is to get people to engage in the process. Maybe it is such a horrific, hellish vision that we can't bring ourselves to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens, you know... I always sort of looked askance, and I don't care if it was a Democrat or a Republican, when they get in front of the TV cameras and they're standing there in front of the microphone and they say, well, our economy is just chugging along at a happy little, our economy is fundamentally strong, our economy is sound, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is look out on the highway and realize how fragile it really, really is.
Uh-huh.
You know, When I can walk into a grocery store 6 miles from my house up here in the middle of nowhere and buy a little tiny jar of caviar, not that I would, for a variety of reasons, but when you can buy caviar in Fayette County, West Virginia, and let me expand on that, when you can buy a live Maine lobster in the middle of the desert in Las Vegas, Nevada, you cannot help but have an economic system that is as thin as tissue paper and as fragile as thin glass. It can't help but be. And that's what I'm that's what I've been asking people to process on, to try to imagine through, to try to think about. And it's, you know, okay, the store shelves don't have as much on it as they used to. Well, some person used to drive the truck that brought that stuff that kept those shelves full.
Yeah.
Well, that person doesn't have a job because that person can't be on the road now. Now, what does that do in his community? What does that do to his, I'm using his, as a, but, you know, it's not necessary. Mm-hmm. But what does that do to his wife? What does that do to his kids? How is he going to keep his house? How is he going to pay the mortgage, even if it's not a BS mortgage? What if it's a real mortgage that was reasonably entered into? How is he going to pay the mortgage on that? How are people going to pay the notes on the, you know, 2,500 square foot double wides that looked like a bargain when they purchased it?
Well, why can't they just divide the money up for us?
Well, that's the $700 billion question, Juanita.
Yeah.
Why are we talking about shearing up the silk suits? Shoring up the silk suits instead of making sure that retirement funds and things that you know, college funds, things like medical savings accounts, why aren't we making sure that they're shored up? You know, there's information out there. I was talking to somebody about it earlier today that suggests, you know, the FDIC, you see that little sign on the window in the bank when you go in, it says, you know, your deposit's insured up to $100,000. Yeah. Well, guess what? The FDIC does not have the liquidity to cover a bank collapse.
Yeah.
Your deposits are not insured up to $100,000.
I went in my bank the other day, and I said, are y'all going to close? And she said, oh, we're doing fine. I said, well, you know, what else is she going to say? And I said, well, I've heard there's going to be 1,000 banks. She said, really? I said, yeah. But I said, you know, when the government collapses, we'll all of the, you know, won't have a bank account. Because now the Social Security recipients, most of them, you go direct to the bank. If you get a check, if you decide to get a check, they're going to charge you a ton of money to cash it somewhere, one of these cash a check you know.
Yeah.
A lot of things going to happen financially. It's a big rippling effect.
And it's a big pond, and the ripples go on forever.
Right. Absolutely.
And this is not
the whole world, actually.
This is not something the rest of the world. We keep calling it a Wall Street bailout. This isn't something that's just happening on Wall Street.
That's right. Absolutely.
This is happening on Main Street.
Right.
And I don't happen to live in a place where you can drive through subdivisions and see sign after, you know, for sale of McMansions.
I hear all the time.
Well, I was about to say, I imagine where you are, though, Juanita, you can see that stuff. But the fact that I can't see it doesn't mean it's not real.
Right, absolutely. And we've got a lot of different, you know, communities. Like, I'm in the suburbs, which is a lower class. I don't know if you call it middle class, but some more so than others would be middle class. I used to always think when I was a kid, I didn't think about being poor. I thought we were middle class, but we were poor.
Well, Juanita, I thank you very kindly. I'm going to roll on here and try to hit a couple more calls, and then I want to make that call to Washington.
Oh, I would love to hear that.
All right. Thank you, Juanita. Have a wonderful evening. Hang in there.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And let's keep it rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
You talking to me, Bob?
I'm talking to you.
Oh, okay. This is Cindy over in the Northwest.
Okay. What's up?
Hey, boy, I love Juanita. You know that. But something's wrong with that phone of hers. I couldn't understand a word she's saying.
Well, we've had to, I don't know. Maybe we'll have to get Juanita a new phone.
Yeah, I'll pitch in. No problem. Needs cash, I'll send her a phone. I'll send it through you. You let me know via email if anything needs be done.
Okie doke.
Breaking news. You ready for this?
Yeah.
FBI is investigating the companies at the heart of the meltdown. This is from Associated Press, Washington. The FBI is investigating four major U.S. financial institutions whose collapse helped trigger a $700 billion bailout plan by the Bush administration. Two law enforcement officials said Tuesday that the FBI is looking at potential fraud by mortgage finance giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Lehman Brothers Holdings Incorporated, and Insure American Independent Group Incorporated. The inquiry, still in preliminary stages, will focus on the financial institutions and the individuals that ran them, a senior law enforcement official said. Officials said the new inquiries brings the number of corporate lenders under investigation over the past year to 26. Spokesman for AIG, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac did not immediately return calls for comment all evening. A Lehman Brothers spokesman did not have an immediate comment. The law enforcement official spoke on condition of anonymity because the investigations are ongoing and they are in the very early stages. Last week, FBI Director Robert Mueller put the number of large financial firms under investigation at 24. He did not name any of the companies under investigation, but said the FBI is looking at whether any of them had misrepresented their assets.
Right. Yeah. The minute you mentioned it, I went and I grabbed that story. What does it mean, Cindy?
It means that what they're looking at is what. I have been busting my hump all week talking to people in Washington. This is a Ponzi scheme. This is a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, this was Amway Goes to Wall Street. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. And they've been running it on us for 8 years now. Well, actually 30, but this was the killer coup of 2000, you know? And it took them 8 years to fool everybody. They fooled everybody, you know?
can I interrupt just for a second, Cindy?
Yeah.
You say they fooled everybody. Don't necessarily buy into that.
I agree.
Well, you know that I'm rather than the Ten Commandments of ancient God, I ascribe to the Three Commandments of W.C. Fields. You can't cheat an honest man, never give a sucker an even break, and don't smarten up a chump. That's the real, those are the real three commandments of the American business model.
That's absolutely true, Bob. Go ahead and finish.
Okay. Well, the first one is the most important one. I've said a million times, Cindy, that it is more true and more profound than most anybody gives it credit for being. You can't cheat an honest man. All right? And what that means, if you sit and just chew on it for a little bit, what that means is that somebody who is honest in his or her dealings will not expect to get something for nothing, will not expect to get this is the investment opportunity of a lifetime. Call now. You know, anybody who does that, you know, deserves the cheat. No, not deserves, but is in for a cheating that they ought to expect because they think that something's going to be there that isn't. All right. And what happened is that these mortgage dodges were dreamed up by a guy who, except for the way he dresses and the cars he rides in, or a group of people, are no different than some guy in the subway running a three-card Monty game. All right? And they passed it off to other organizations that were in the investment game because you can't lose. It's just going to the real estate is the most solid investment vehicle you can. You've heard it, Cindy. I know
I
you have.
C-SPAN. What you heard that guy? Did you watch C-SPAN today?
No. Actually, I didn't.
Paulson was doing his double talk like some sort of a used car salesman.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I did see some of Paulson. But what I'm getting at here is that all of this phony baloney mortgage scam was phony baloney from the minute that it started. Now, I know there are people out there that want to say, well, you know, it was the fault of the lenders for You had to take advantage of the system to lend money to people who had no business getting loans. Well, no, not so much.
I want to go there for just 1 minute.
Go ahead.
I've been intimately connected with a couple who's in foreclosure right now. Remember I told you about that?
Yeah.
And my family's been helping to make their payment 3 years because the unemployment that this family ran into was not of their making and not their fault, and they've been working their way out of it. And that three-year help on their income has kept that family out of the cold and kept them from moving into my house, actually. You know, sometimes it's easier to help your friend out there than it is to bring them in your house to live. We learned that lesson. But this couple went for one of those sliding scale mortgages, and that was the heart of their problem. They could live with the cost of their home. They could live with the cost of their standard of living. But what they couldn't live with was balloon payments, finance charges that were like punishment charges for not paying the balloon payment. And then ultimately, because there was a missed balloon payment or something, then all of a sudden their rates start climbing and climbing because they're at risk. And once they miss one payment, it begins to snowball. And this couple made one.
Yeah, it's the mortgage equivalent of a credit card debt that's going bad.
The next thing that's going to hit is the credit cards. It's going to happen again. This isn't the end of it. This is just their latest run. They made three runs at our treasury this summer so far, and this is the third, and the next run is going to be at credit cards, and that's what I was talking to lawmakers today about. This is a Ponzi scheme. They're draining us dry. They're trying to cripple our treasury so that when the next president goes into office, irregardless of who it is, cannot afford to give us anything, no health care, no school money, no
infrastructure. Right.
No, Social Security. Everything goes down the tubes, and we all sit here with our thumbs up our butts after working for all our lives. You know?
Well, that's why last night I kept. That's why I said, you know, several times in the space of a couple of minutes, we have been beaten by a flank attack. Okay, it's not a criticism. We've sat here, Cindy, saying, you know, we want health care, we got to rebuild the infrastructure, yada yada yada, and you know, it's all true and it's all valid, but there are forces at work that are very much opposed to universal health care, to spending money on infrastructure, for doing anything but giving money to the wealthiest 0.1% of this country. And they figured out that while they were really, really getting their butts handed to them in a frontal assault, they figured out they could flank us. And that's what all this bailout is. It is making sure that in case Obama should happen to be elected, that he can't do anything for the middle class, or what I prefer to call the working class.
Let me ask you a question. I want to word this correctly. Since when does our government bail out a person who has committed a crime? I mean, let's say...
You really want the answer to that?
Well, no, I mean, if somebody has committed a crime and they've robbed somebody, yeah, I just thought about Ken Lay. He made off with his money. Do you really believe Ken Lay is dead? I don't.
You know, that whole thing was kind of hard to swallow. But you say, well, yeah. Since when did we do that? Ask my senator. Okay, Cindy, ask John D. Rockefeller IV, since when do we bail out people who have committed criminal acts? Ask him that question. Well, you can't because you don't get anything but voicemail when you call his office. But ask him that question, because he was part and parcel. He was the heart and soul of the immunity that we gave the telecoms for spying on us. Wasn't he?
I
mean, didn't we just do that in the last few months? FISA, all of that?
Yeah. The whole thing has been a nightmare. A nightmare. And you saw the emails that I sent out this week. There was the one about the U.S. Army from Army Times being on October 1st on an ongoing rotating permanent basis within our borders to quell any unrest. And they're being deployed October 1st next month. And they're coming out of a Northern Command Unit in Montana and Colorado. It's a new It's a new protection unit that was invented in 2006 by Dick Cheney. And that Northern Command is going to deploy troops across the USA to quell the violence. And that's already been planned. It's in the Army Times. The troops are already given their assignments, and they're ready to go. And what do you think was in the mind of the military to put this together? What kind of violence are they expecting during an election here in America? What do you think?
I don't know that it's I don't think it's violence during the election that they're expecting. It's the kind of stuff that was in that story of the 100 displaced workers who beat the shop owner to death or the company owner to death. That
I think that America is about to learn a lesson that other nations have learned before. And this is why I've been telling everybody to save those seeds and get self-sufficient. Get that little piece of land and learn to do that garden.
Yeah, but winter's coming. What are we going to do if the shelves get empty in January?
Well, let me explain something. Last time we had a depression, we didn't have the tools that we have now. Last depression, there was no internet. There was hardly any telephone, let alone cell phones that are portable telephones. Not too many people have reliable vehicles that could go from one end of the continent to the other end. We do now. People were not clothed as well, and they were not supplied as well. There are millions of people across this nation who have been packing in supplies for the last 8 years because we've all been smart enough to see what's going down. And it isn't just Democrats. It's Democrats, Republicans, liberals. It's people that are libertarians. The stuff has been for sale on the net for the last decade. Everybody's been looking at this. And this is it, guys. This is it. And anybody that made preparations and got ready will be better off than the others. And the ones that are not better off have better hope to God that the other ones are feeling generous when they come politely asking. Because my father told me in Depression, there were people that were hungry and without. And if they came knocking at the door politely, you would give them a chore to do. For instance, if you go and collect the eggs from the chicken coop for me this morning, I'll cook you up an omelet and make sure you get a good meal, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And that kind of thing was done.
I got those stories too, Cindy. This house that we're in was built in 1936. All right.
Oh, I know.
And from the minute that the door was opened for the first time, there was somebody sleeping on the couch, if not two or three people, to the point that my grandmother's favorite poem was one that that had as its key line, "I want to live in a house by the side of the road and be a friend to man," because that's what she and her husband did.
Yeah, and there's a lot of good people like that. There's a lot of good people like that. I've already got a network of friends set up, and there are people that are homeowners and who the haves, and I'm lucky enough to be one of the haves because I have a little patch of land that I can grow food on and the know-how and the tools to survive. And I went to town, and I talked to some of my friends in town and told them, you know, you keep this under your hat, but if it hits the fan and the shelves are empty, you know, it's right now I have 26 tomato plants that are full of ripe tomatoes. We've got hundreds of pounds of tomato plants coming in, and it's this weekend is when we'll start harvesting. And I got friends coming over to help me with the harvest, and we're going to be canning tomatoes. And, you know, I get so many of them, I'm giving it away free. And the way that I figure out who gets it is families with children get first. You know, they get first. And everybody's got to bring their own jars and lids because I can't afford all that stuff. And anybody that doesn't know how to do it gets a lesson in how to do it. And we just make it a neighborhood affair. We teach the young people how to take care of themselves, you know. And that starts up this weekend. So that's the kind of thing that I've been doing now for 10 years. And, nobody that belongs to any church and no preaching is allowed thing. I don't want to hear anybody say, oh, the Lord sent me. If you think the Lord sent you, then go talk to the preacher, man, because this ain't nothing to do with church.
Yeah.
I won't have it.
No,
I won't have it. Anybody says one thing like that, they're out. And, Bob, I'll have you know I'm a Christian woman, but I won't have that.
I don't blame you. You know, I was having lunch with somebody the other day, and went up to go back to the buffet bar, and here was a bunch of fundies with their, you know, fundy ladies with their hair done up to Jesus, praying so loud you could hear them three booths over. And I don't mean to be a jerk or anything, but it made me outright mad. Because I couldn't help thinking about that passage where the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer said, if you got something to say, get into a closet and say it and get out and get on with your business. Don't be like the Pharisees and pray loud in the streets. And of course, we're also talking about we've been talking about 80, 100 years ago, the great labor songwriter, bard, troubadour, Joe Hill, wrote those great lines, live on hay, and he got this from observing Salvation Army workers, live on hay day by day, there'll be pie in the sky when you die.
There'll be pie in the sky when you die, that's right.
And and Jesus himself said, feed my sheep.
Breaking news for today, Bob.
All right. Well, Cindy, thank you very much. I appreciate your time this evening.
Before I go, one more breaking news.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, I thought you said that year. Okay, I lost you a little bit. Go ahead.
Teamsters went out on strike today all over the country.
Well, good on them. Who all was
it? It's the biggest Teamster strike since 1979.
And it was car carrying companies for the most part, wasn't it?
It's car carrying. It's UPS went out. Car carriers went out. Grocery haulers went out. Dry goods went out. Restauranters went out. So there's no food at the restaurant, no food at the grocery store, no UPS deliveries.
And that's nationwide?
Yeah. Nationwide. Yeah.
It's only going to get more interesting.
And companies are grabbing scabs already. They got them lined up, you know.
Oh, sure.
So I was on the horn to the Teamsters today telling them how back in the day when my mom had me out on the first strike line when I was 8 years old. And what we used to do back then is the men would go to the strike because mostly women didn't work back then. The men would go to the picket line and the women and the children would go to the grocery store with our own picket signs and we'd pick at the grocery store for better prices. We want cheaper milk, and we want cheaper eggs, and we want cheaper cereal. We're hungry. And we did not tell them that we were the wives of the Teamsters. We told them we were the housewives of the neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
So it was like a separate strike. We didn't, you know, mix them. And we put pressure on the grocery, and we put pressure on the suppliers. And we used to break those strikes fast and get our way with them. But these days, it's just the picket line and the news that won't talk to anybody. And the women and children, you know, they're on the soccer field playing soccer instead of at the grocery store on a picket line where they belong. And they wonder why this is happening to them.
Yeah.
The younger generation got a lot to learn.
Amen to that. They do.
But
those kind of lessons are lessons hard taught and harder learned.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they've got a lot to learn, there ain't but one way to learn it, and that's the hard one. That's the hard one.
So I want to make sure I got that Teamster story out there so that if there's anybody in your listening audience, you get thyself to the grocery store and get what you need for a while.
Not a bad idea at all. Of course, I hate to say this, but since they're a bunch of union-busting horses' rear ends, Wally World will be stocked. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody's got their own location and everybody's got their own set of stores and they know how this kind of a strike will affect them. So find out what's going on in your neighborhood and take care of yourself because we don't want this audience to shrink.
No, we don't. And it's hard enough for this audience to keep us going. Yeah. And I know.
Yeah.
So, All right. Well, Cindy, thank you very much, dear.
Okay.
And best of luck with the tomatoes.
Oh, thanks, Bob. Come, I wish you were close. I'd send you some.
Oh,
you know?
Golly Moses, don't I too. Come February, the last couple of jars of home canned tomatoes will just about get you through to spring. Cause, you know.
Yeah, I still got home canned tomatoes from last year on my cupboard.
Hot diggity. Hot diggity.
That's how much I had.
I'm sitting here salivating. I, honest to God, I'm sitting here salivating. So
they're so good.
Yes, they are.
But they're so good.
Oh, and, one of my favorite things in the world is to take a jar of those things and make homemade stewed tomatoes over fresh hot biscuits and. Wow.
Oh, and you know, back in the days when times were hard, I used to live on those mustard sandwiches. And it was a treat if you could find an onion to chop up and put in it. I grew up on those. You know? For me, mayonnaise was a treat.
Exactly. And, you know, that's another thing. Time to learn to make your own mayonnaise.
Yeah. And that's not so hard to do.
As long as there's electricity to the blender, you're in good shape. And you got a steady hand to pour the oil.
It's time to lay in a good supply of all kinds of good beans to eat because there isn't going to be any meat on the market. So, you know, I've already gotten myself into that vegetarian mode, and I know how to make all those great dishes. So if times get tough, I'll just, pull out the old recipe cards on the show and give out some good recipes.
Sounds yummy. I think we'll all be the better for it, Cindy.
Okay, Bob, I'll let you go so you can get another call in.
Yeah, take care and our best to all of yours.
Okay, and ours to you.
All right, thanks. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
All them tomatoes are going to be good in the dead of winter. They're going to be yummy. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, you talking to me?
I'm talking to you.
Hey, awesome, man. I just wanted to call and let you know I'm a first-time listener. I found you on iTunes. And I wanted to go ahead and first explain my story a bit. I'm 25 years old. And when I graduated high school, my parents were probably about lower middle class or middle class or so, and I was living with them. So I was get a little bit of a government assistance and stuff to go ahead and put myself through college.
Okay.
So I ended up joining the Virginia National Guard to go ahead and help foot the bill. They were saying they would go ahead and pay for 100% of the tuition, you know, if I went ahead and filled my obligation. So I went ahead and I tried doing that. But then the government said, hey, sorry, we don't have enough money to pay you. So I was like, you know, I'm trying to fulfill my contractual obligation. I expect you guys to do the same. They didn't, so I got out. Then I got a job at a local hardware store, you know, and they were going to go ahead and reimburse me for 75% of my tuition.
Mm-hmm.
So I went ahead and, you know, I went to my bank. And with what little money I had left, I could pay for my first semester, you know, and I continuously did that and went in debt to go ahead and put myself through school. And when I finished going to school, you know, I got a few associate's degrees because I couldn't afford to go to a four-year university, and I got a job. And now me and my wife, she went to a local four-year university, and she went ahead and she got a job as well. Now, one of the questions I have is, why is it when the government offers so many people all these opportunities and when a bunch of companies offer people opportunities, how come they don't go ahead? And like your last caller was saying, you know, she was taught to be a little bit more self-sufficient. But why is it when, you know, things don't go people's ways and, you know, like if they go ahead and they get a bad mortgage or something like that that they willingly signed into, why that everybody goes ahead and starts pointing fingers? What happened to, you know, personal accountability, you know?
Yeah, I do that. And I'm sorry, I didn't get your name. First name, first name's fine. Go ahead. Pardon?
David.
Okay. The personal accountability thing is always kind of a bête noire of the right. It's something they like for us to have and for them to be free of. And I'm sorry to define things in terms of us and them, but it really is. For instance, a family that got one of these, if you were listening to Cindy earlier, there were people who got into these mortgages who didn't, they weren't looking for something for nothing. But disclosure, you ever sat in on a home closing? I have.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I went ahead and I purchased the house.
Well, you know the disclosures that are in I don't know if your word processing program has a font size that's as small as what appears on the lending disclosures.
Oh, right. I understand.
They came up with whatever that was needed on the front end. They met their mortgage payments, and then boom, you know, the expanded rates kicked in, or the increased rates kicked in, and the next thing you know, what was a deal for 5 years becomes a nightmare in year six.
Right, and I understand that. But, you know, like, I guess, like, when I went ahead and I was buying my house, my mortgage broker gave me several options, one of them being an ARM, you know, and trying to be an informed buyer, I went ahead and I asked what an ARM was or what it stood for, and she said adjustable rate mortgage. And that right there, you know, that was kind of my clue as to this doesn't sound good, you know, because of the adjustable rate.
Right, and the house always wins.
Right. Now, if it's an adjustable rate, and like, my understanding is the adjustable rates came out and everything back when they were trying to get more people to go ahead and buy houses and flip the houses and then resell them for a profit. And, you know, I mean, even if that's not the case, you know, I guess it's a good methodology to use with that, with the ARM. But a lot of people were getting ensnared with the adjustable rates and everything. It was kind of enticing, I guess. But then again, you know, isn't that buyer beware? Isn't that...
Oh, caveat emptor always obtains. But again, I go back to disclosure. And also the fundamental inability of most people to imagine worst-case scenarios. In debt situations, it's always wise to imagine not the best case, but the worst one. What happens if everything gets sideways? What happens if I get totally upside down on this mortgage?
Right.
And most people don't want to do that. You know, last night I was going over that commencement address by David Foster Wallace, and he was talking about the default positions inside our own minds. And our default position, most folks, is to think that it's going to get better, because thinking that it's going to get worse is it's almost unendurable. In this or any other society or culture. And the fact of the matter is that this there's every reason to believe that the Wall Street mortgage crisis was in fact a product of fraud. That this was dreamed up. You know, there are these legions of lawyers and accountants and brokers who sit around trying to come up with what they call financial products. Now, you know, like I said earlier, I see a can of beans on the shelf. That's a product. You know, a life insurance policy, they call those, no, that ain't a product. And neither is some investment scam. So it was, and it's so terribly difficult to understand, but individuals taking out mortgages, you know, they were the marks on the low end of the food chain. Because the whole idea out of this was to make money fast by shifting around these mortgages too quickly for anybody to be able to see what was going on. The only problem was they ran, if I understand it correctly, they ran out of places to hustle this stuff too. Well, you ever played Old Maid?
Actually, I can't say I have.
Well, it's a children's card game where whoever's holding, I guess, the Queen of Spades at the end of the game, and everybody swaps cards. And you're constant, if you get the Queen of Spades in your hand, you're trying to get somebody else to take it, somebody else to get stuck with it, somebody else to hold it, because whoever's holding it at the end is the loser. And that's what happened in this mortgage scam. They ran out of people to get to hold the Old Maid.
Right. And you know, I'll go ahead and I'll give you that. However, when you were saying about the disclosure forms and stuff like that, I've always been told when I was signing papers to join the military, when I was signing papers to go to school, when I was signing papers to go ahead and buy a product such as my car, whenever I've done anything or an investment in my education, I've always read the fine print. And I think I've benefited because of that, because I've been able to avoid low-rate mortgages. And now, you know, like, I guess it's because maybe it's my responsibility, and I'm not, like, trying to say that these lenders are being predators, because I'd like to think that they had good intention, you know, but there's just a lot of people, in my opinion, I guess, who do kind of want to go ahead and take the easier way out. If someone says, you can buy this $350,000 home with a low APR, a lot of people are going to jump on that, you know. But, I mean, I think it's also their responsibility to look into what they are actually getting themselves into. My parents always told me, you know, you have nobody will look out for you in this world. You have to look out for yourself. And to be true. No one cares about me. You know, where I live, we see it all the time.
Well, okay, let's analyze that for a minute, David, if you don't mind. Are you familiar with, say, Rent-A-Center?
Yes, without a doubt.
Okay. It seems, for people in desperate circumstances, it seems fairly, you know, hey, the freezer's busted. We'll go get a new freezer, and all we got to do is pay $10 a week.
Sure, yeah.
But on the back end of that is how long you're paying $10 a week, and there's no disclosure of what you're actually paying in terms of an interest rate. So no matter how good you are at reading the fine print, you still get busted. And to a certain extent, that happened in the mortgage market. You've got the urge to own your own place, the urge to not rent, the urge to have a roof, you know, that really is the chief element of the American dream, to have your own place, right? And you take people who want that, and they want it desperately, and it's put out there, you can finally own your own home.
Yeah, and everybody should own their own home. However, before you own your own home, I think that a lot of people need to go ahead and keep their, you know, like, check their finances, you know, and check what they're getting themselves into, because owning a home isn't just owning a home. And I think every single person who goes to buy a house knows that there is going to be a mortgage associated with that, and with the mortgage it is going to be an interest rate. And
let me interrupt you just for a second. And yes. those are rational statements, David, and I don't take issue with them. But they are rational statements that do not exist in a vacuum, okay? Turn on the television. Now, they're not there anymore, but once upon a time a few years back, literally, you couldn't watch a news channel, you couldn't watch a cable channel without seeing three or four DITEC ads.
Yep.
Inside of, and you know, approval takes only moments. Call over the phone, blah, blah, blah. And so it's not just people who are getting their first homes. These were people who were wrangled into second mortgages that are
refinancing and all that other stuff.
Yeah, that are just as devastating as if it was a first mortgage on of dubious qualities. And that's part of our so-called consumer culture. Get. Let's see. You need new soap because you stink if you don't buy it. Women are victimized all over this country, your hair's the wrong color. Ooh, you know, your skirts are too long or too short for this season. And it's a perfect little microcosm for the world that we all live in terms of what we're subjected to that shapes the perceptions that we take into individual transactions. Does this make any sense?
Yeah, it makes sense, and I guess I can see it from your viewpoint, but I might have to deal with, I really think it just comes down to, I guess, different viewpoints, you know, because like I said, I'm a firm believer in personal accountability and stuff like that, and maybe it's just because I did play my cards right, you know, or maybe it's
well, and yeah, and if you're if you're new to the program, I should tell you that, you know, this is a group process. So I'm getting comments here from listeners in the chat room, folks emailing. One says tell David that not everyone is blessed with a college level IQ. I've got another remark here that says, What would have happened if getting out of the military had been as hard as getting out of a mortgage? Not people attacking, but, you know, just food for thought kind of thing. And I would throw this last thing in there, David. And that is this. when you're talking about personal responsibility, you are talking about the personal responsibility of literally millions of people, okay?
Sure, yeah.
It's not unlikely. It is statistically and physically impossible that they entered into some decision to be personally irresponsible. And to suggest that the same thing happened on a million different occasions is far less statistically likely than that some sort of skullduggery happened on one or two or three or four occasions. Any conspiracy fails once it gets outside of, you know, three.
Right.
You know, a committee of six can't decide where to have lunch.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is while I'm sure there are individual isolated instances of financial irresponsibility, I find it much more likely, given the gambling nature of Wall Street, that more of the onus goes there.
But isn't that capitalism? Like, I mean, if that's the point of these institutions, to go ahead and take a risk and to go ahead and profit from that.
Well,
risk.
It really isn't. Capitalism within the Adam Smith definition of the word. It's not exactly a jaunt through the Sunday comics to sit down and do Adam Smith. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't. But there's an idea that everybody shares the risk in Adam Smith style capitalism. This isn't that. When John McCain's one of his chief advisors, Carly Fiorina, former Hewlett Packard CEO. This woman was fired. Okay, now let's talk about this in terms of market economics and the free market and everything. This woman was fired. She did a poor enough job as CEO of Hewlett Packard that she was fired. Okay, well, she screwed up Hewlett Packard, and in return for screwing up Hewlett Packard, she was rewarded with $40 million.
Right.
Now, that ain't Adam Smith capitalism.
No, and I disagree with that completely. I think if you get fired, I'm not much a fan of severance pays, especially if you're, you know, if you're laid off or something like that, I can understand. But if you do something to go ahead and harm a business, you know, what should you get? Nothing. You know, you should get a nice pat on the butt as you're out the door.
Right, but nobody, that's not happening on Wall Street.
Not happening on Wall Street.
But,
you know, like when we were just talking about, you know, millions of people defaulting on their loans. I just heard recently, or read recently, I'm not sure which, that is something around or maybe just above 98% of Americans haven't defaulted on their loan. You know what I mean? So then it's kind of hard for me to feel bad for this very, very small percentage. Even though it's a great number of people, it's still a small percentage of people who are defaulting. You know what I mean? I guess it's just hard for me to see it, you know? Like, I don't know. I guess it's just a personal accountability. And like, you know, one of your people said, I guess maybe it is. I've been blessed with a college-level IQ, which, you know, I developed through studying. I wasn't born with it. I had to study to be like this.
Well, that's the nature versus nurture argument. I mean, among other things, every woman in America, and this is not statistical, this is, you know, you can take a hair sample from any woman of childbearing age in this country now, and she has enough mercury in her system from coal-fired power plants, coal burning for energy, she has enough mercury in her system to account for a 10-point IQ deficit in any child that she bears. Okay,
right.
So that's not a product of study. That kid can study all that kid wants to, but there's going to be a 10-point IQ hole there that wasn't brought on by study or the absence thereof.
And again, being ignorant to a mortgage in the mortgage industry, and then being a first-time home buyer and deciding to go ahead and actually do a little bit of reading before I went ahead and signed any papers, and even reading the papers I was signing.
Well, what do you do with the guy who's out there hustling the mortgage, and the person actually reads it and says, you know, things are looking kind of different in year six, and the mortgage lender says, well, you know, hey, look at the economy. The economy's booming. Yeah, that's not going to be a problem for you. You're going to do great. You know, if you look at the old definition of common law fraud, And, of course, fraud is what the FBI is now investigating these Wall Street banking houses for. The old definition of common law fraud was a detrimental reliance upon a fraudulent representation that resulted in damages. Okay? Detrimental reliance? Well, you know, if you're saying, nah, it's going to be good, you know. Boom! Fraud! So what, you know, and you, when you're being actively defrauded, you cannot be held to account for personal responsibility when someone is playing a scam on you.
Yeah, but how is it a scam when these people know that the adjustable rate will fluctuate? If they read the fine print, the interest rate will fluctuate at some point in the future. And now,
but look what the interest rates have been. Here, let me pull out my graph here. See, look, the interest rates are going down. They're going down. Yeah. They're going down. Yeah, nothing to worry about.
Go ahead and stimulate the economy and stuff like that. But what I'm saying is the mortgage rates and stuff like that.
But please bear in mind, David, that when we talk about the mortgage crisis, we're not talking about people trying to get away with something for nothing. Nobody's out there saying that they're going to get a paid-off house out of this. Nobody's advocating for that. What we're talking about is giving people an opportunity to stay in their homes. And you've already acknowledged that home ownership is one of the most valuable things to this to the American economy.
Without a doubt, I agree with that.
So you know what's who loses here? If we give the power to a bankruptcy judge to keep somebody in their house if there is a reasonable likelihood of them being able to make the payments, that's the very heart and soul of bankruptcy, is to keep people in as much as possible in some form of a position where they can continue to participate in the economy while relieving them of debts that there is no chance of them paying.
Right.
You know,
I'll go ahead and I'm not going to agree completely with everything here, and I guess a reason I'm not going to, and I guess here's the kicker, I'm a Republican.
Well, I could kind of tell.
Yeah, you know, so I mean, we're just going to disagree on some things, but I did want to go ahead and call since I do like listening to talk radio and engaging with audiences and stuff like that, and especially the host.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, we call what we do here, David, Conversation Radio. If I don't know if you've noticed or not, but I have not asked you to hold on while we advertise. Buy gold now. You know, that's the heart and soul. You're welcome. You're welcome to engage in this discussion anytime you choose. Tell your friends. Tell your neighbors.
Well, hey, you know, maybe I'll go ahead and I'll just be one of those inquisitive conservatives or Republicans that has to call up every once in a while to go ahead and just get the liberal viewpoint on some things because, you know. Like I said, you know, I only see it from my angle. You know, it's kind of hard to see it from other angles. So,
yeah, and you know, that really is the heart and soul of the game, is to try to get outside our own skulls and wonder what it feels like to be somebody who is going to be living in the worn out minivan tomorrow.
Right. Yeah.
Because if you can do that, you're well along the way toward an enlightened Americanism.
Right, yeah. And, you know, and I certainly hope that one day I could go ahead and actually empathize or maybe even experience something like this. You know, I mean, God forbid I do, but, you know, maybe it'll go ahead and help change my view on things. But I'm going to have to go ahead and get going because
right.
My wife's finishing up dinner. I just want to go ahead and thank
well,
you.
Well, bon appetit, and bon appetit and our best regards to your lovely wife.
All right, thank you much. And I apologize to your audience for having to listen to me go on with
No, don't apologize. It's Conversation Radio. It's what we do.
All right, take care of yourself.
Take care, David. Bye now. And let's see. Oh, no, you left. So I guess that's where we close off. I mentioned a line from a poem before I talked to, when I was talking to Cindy. It's fairly short. I think I've got enough time to get this out. It's the one that my grandmother lived by. Written by Sam Walter Foss, 1858 to 9/11. And you hear something like this. I heard this all my life growing up. It's part of why I am how I am. There are hermit souls that live withdrawn in the peace of their self-content. There are souls like stars that dwell apart in a fellowless firmament. There are pioneer souls that blaze their paths where highways never ran. But let me live by the side of the road and be a friend to man. Let me live in a house by the side of the road, where the race of men go by, the men who are as good and the men who are bad, as good and as bad as I. I would not sit in the scorner's seat or hurl the cynic's ban. Let me live in a house by the side of the road and be a friend to man. I see from my house by the side of the road, by the side of the highway of life, the men who press with the ardor of hope, the men who are faint with the strife, but I turn not away from their smiles nor their tears, both parts of an infinite plan. Let me live in my house by the side of the road and be a friend to man. I know there are brook-gladdened meadows ahead and mountains of wearisome height, that the road passes on through the long afternoon and stretches away to the night. But I still rejoice when the travelers rejoice, and weep with the strangers that moan, nor live in my house by the side of the road like a man who dwells alone. Let me live in my house by the side of the road where the race of men go by.